Simon & Schuster Audio presents Tom Clancy's Power Plays. BioStrike by Jerome Preisler. Created by Tom Clancy and Martin Greenberg. Read by George DeCenzo.
Various locales, October 15th, 2001. American cities run by the clock. This is truest of the largest and busiest, where the minute hand impels people through their routines without room for pause. It was largely because of its precise adherence to schedule, tidal inflow and outflow of humanity, that chose ground zero for the northeastern seaboard of the United States, the epicenter of an explosion that would be neither heard nor felt by the thousands of souls it overtook, yet was potentially more catastrophic than a full-scale nuclear assault. Inconspicuous as the weapon he was carrying, the man in the dark blue suit walked past the statue of George Washington in Federal Plaza to the impressive Greek Revival building on Wall Street, and a swarm of traders and clerks eager to make the opening bell. A tobacco leather briefcase in his right hand, he climbed the broad outer stairs, passed under the stone pediment with its sculpted gods of finance and invention, and strode through the entrance onto the main trading floor. Scanning the room, he discovered an unoccupied phone stall, jostled toward it, placed his briefcase on the floor near his feet, and lifted the receiver. His hand on the hook, he randomly keyed in a number and pretended to make a call. He would stand there waiting until the time was right. A few moments later, the bell rang out from the platform, and the nation's most powerful engine of commerce jolted into high gear. The silent phone cradled between his chin and shoulder, he leaned down and pushed a catch beside one of the briefcase's combination locks. The latch did not snap open, nor had that been his intent. Still bent over the case, he heard a low sound issue from its side panel, like a venomous snake. Lifting his case, the man in the dark blue suit hung up the receiver and stepped back into the crowd. In the general commotion, the expulsion of aerosol couldn't be heard. Soon he left the exchange and turned onto Broad Street, the canister in his briefcase emptied of its unseen contents. If what he had released wasn't already out there on the street, it would be. Soon enough, it would be everywhere. A Boeing 747 wide-body jumbo jet can carry over 400 passengers on an international trip, seating as many as 10 abreast, far exceeding the capacity of other commercial airliners. For Steve Whitford, this had been so much a mixed blessing that he found himself happily awaiting his layover as his flight taxied to a halt in Sydney. Steve unfastened his seatbelt, slid into the aisle, and took the flight attendant's advice, stretching, massaging the small of his back with his knuckles. His achiness and complaints aside, he had to admit that there were worse things in life than rubbing up against his neighbor in the window seat. He glanced over at her, an appealing blonde of about 30 in a sort of retro hippie-ish outfit consisting of a peasant blouse, hip-hugging bell-bottoms, and big, round, red earrings like three-dimensional polka dots. Not that she didn't look good. In fact, he'd been very aware of how good she looked the moment they boarded the jet in Hong Kong, and had tried striking up a conversation with her soon after takeoff. He told her his name, that he was an attorney who had been in Asia doing some patent and licensing work for a Massachusetts-based toy manufacturer, and that he was about to take a few days R&R in London before returning to the grind. She, in turn, introduced herself as Melinda, no surname given and none asked. Her English subtly laced with an accent he couldn't associate with any particular nationality. Steve got his travel bag out of the overhead storage compartment, figuring he'd find a restaurant, eat a halfway decent meal, then maybe slap some cologne on his face in the restroom to freshen up for the next long leg of the transcontinental haul. He took a breath and leaned toward her. "Excuse me, I was wondering if you'd like to join me for a cup of coffee, maybe grab a quick bite, my treat?" Her smile was polite, nothing more, nothing less. "Thank you. but I really have to fill these out. She placed the postcards on her tray table. Yes, you do have a fair-sized stack there. She looked at him. You know how it is with obligations. They're like plagues on my mind. Sure, whatever you say, he thought. He told her he'd see her later, turned back into the aisle, and filed toward the exit with the other debarking passengers. She waited, her eyes following him until he stepped off the plane. Then she rapidly got down to business. She removed the top of her pen and dropped it onto her tray beside the postcards. The ink cartridge was metal, with a small plastic cap above the refill opening. She twisted the cap to loosen the cartridge, slipped it out of the pen, and put the bottom half of the pen beside the other items on the tray. Little plagues, she thought. The man who was both her employer and lover might have appreciated, though he surely would have disapproved of her speaking them aloud. Her thumb and forefinger tweezered around the cap. She separated it from the cylinder cartridge with an easy pull. Careful that no one was watching, she held the cartridge away from herself, turned it upside down, and tapped it with her fingertip. A powdery white substance sprinkled out and immediately dispersed in the cabin's cycling air. Entering the respiratory tracts of the aircraft's crew and passengers, the microscopic capsules would release the dormant presences within them. Transmitted from person to person, airport to airport, and city to city, spread across nations and continents by their hosts, these unsuspected invaders would aggressively do what they had been created to do. The plane was empty except for a handful of passengers and one male flight attendant near the exit, and she smiled at him as she left the plane. Her next flight was slotted for departure in just over 2 hours. It would be the seventh and last, and she knew better than to believe the number was coincidence. No, it was without question a demonic fancy, a conceit of the fiend to whom she had given herself willingly, needfully, body and soul. Sight being its only faculty, the eye trusts what it sees. This makes it easily fooled. In San Jose, California, a municipal street sweeper brought the aerosol payload through the target zone, dispensing it from an extra spray reservoir aboard its heavy steel frame. An everyday part of the urban scene, the sweeper barely scratched the surface of people's awareness, their eyes seeing nothing amiss, no disruption in the orderly and ordinary course of their lives. They went on to their workplaces without an inkling that they had become carriers of a wholly new and insidious type of infection, many of them heading north on Rosita Avenue toward the high, sleek office spire that was the famed main headquarters of Uplink International, far and away their city's largest corporate employer. Hardly by chance, the street sweeper kept moving in the same direction. When Roger Gordian's daughter telephoned him on her way home from the courthouse, he didn't know what to say. Julia was a remarkably competent 33-year-old woman who had led her own life for many years, and she deserved better than stale, fatherly programming from him, difficult as that sometimes was. It's over. My divorce is final, she spoke over her cellular. The paperwork signed, and I should be getting copies in a couple of weeks. Gordian was not by disposition an introspective man. He saw his mind and feelings as fairly uncomplicated. He loved his wife and two daughters, and he loved his work, the work less. Though for some years it had consumed a greater share of his time than it should have, and the family had felt bumped to the sidelines. The importance of being an earner, a provider, had been fostered in him early in life. His father had died before the term quality time was coined, but it was doubtful Thomas Gordian would have been able to grasp the concept in any event. For the elder Gordian, bringing home a paycheck was how you expressed your love of family, and that dogged blue-collar sensibility had taken deep root in his only son, enduring long after he'd returned from Vietnam and, with the help of loan officers and a handful of far-sighted investors, purchased a limping, debt-ridden San Jose outfit called Global Technologies for the giveaway price of $12 million. The rewards of his gamble far exceeded Gordian's hopes. In less than a decade, he turned global into a Silicon Valley giant with a slew of tremendously successful defense industry patents. He had used the technological windfall from his development of GAPS-free advanced military reconnaissance and targeting equipment to propel his firm to the leading edge of civilian satellite communications and rechristened it Uplink International. By the time his corporation went multinational in 1990, Gordian's thoughts had slung outward to pursue what his wife usually referred to as the dream, based upon an idea as straightforward as his personality. Information equaled freedom. As head of the world's most extensive civilian telecommunications network, he'd been in a position to bring people access to information, a currency with which he could buy better lives for untold millions, particularly where totalitarian regimes sustain themselves by doing the very opposite, choking off the gateways of communication, isolating their citizens from knowledge that might challenge their strangleholds of oppression. Again, Gordian's triumphs went far beyond his expectations. But, ironically, the signals Ashley was sending from home about her own unhappiness weren't getting through the bottleneck of humanitarian goals he'd continue to pursue. Not until she'd compelled his attention with words he would remember for the rest of his days. "I know that everything you've accomplished in the world makes a huge difference to people everywhere. I know it's your calling, something you have to do. What I don't know is if I'm strong enough to wait until you're done." Her words, those shattering, unforgettable words, had forced him to look into a deep mirror and see things about himself that were difficult to accept. Far more importantly, they also saved his marriage.
"Dad, you still with me? I'm on the highway ramp and it's pretty noisy."
"Right here, hon." Gordian tried to pull his thoughts together. "I'm just glad the worst of the ordeal's behind you and that you can get on with your life." She produced a sharp laugh.
"You know what happened when we were leaving court? After everything we've been through, all the legal sniping, all the ugliness, he asked me to have lunch with him."
He, common noun, had once been referred to by name, Craig, her husband of 7 years. "It's behind you now, Julia. You can move on. Let's be glad for that." Gordian heard car horns squalling at the other end of the line.
"Better go. Traffic's a mess. I'll be home in time for dinner."
But it was barely 9 o'clock in the morning, Gordian thought. "There are quite a few hours between now and then. How are you planning to fill them?" Then her tone suddenly brittle.
"Did you want a complete schedule?"
Gordian raised his eyebrows, puzzled. His fingers tightened around the receiver.
"Goes and fax something over for your approval."
Gordian made a gesture of frustration into the empty room. "Julia."
"I'm a grown woman. I don't think you need a full rundown on my comings and goings in advance."
"Julia, hang on."
"See you later."
The connection broke.
"Blew it," Gordian scolded himself. "Somehow you blew it again."
And try as he did to see where he had gone wrong, he could not. Many stories below on Rosita Avenue, a street sweeper shot past the building as Gordian's employees began to arrive for the commencing workday. But the clamor of its equipment would not have impinged upon his thoughts, even had it reached the heavy floor-to-ceiling windows of his office. From where he was sitting, alone at his desk, the dead, silent telephone still clenched in his hand. From where he was sitting right now, the rest of the world seemed immeasurably far away. La Paz, Bolivia, November 3, 2001. President-elect Alberto Colón's room was segregated from the rest of the intensive care ward and guarded by troops of the Fuerza Especial de Lucha contra el Narcotráfico, or FELS, the military's elite anti-narcotics force. Dr. Alvarez led Father Martín quickly through the security check and then down a long hall to its door. Martín entered the room. Inside, oxygen hissed through soft rubber tubes, snaking from the artificial ventilation unit into the patient's nostrils, then down behind his tongue into the pharynx. He was either unconscious or asleep, the lesions on his eyelids, cheeks, and lips showing in angry contrast to his waxen pallor.
His blankets had been turned down to free his bare right arm for the intravenous drip lines. Patched with a scarlet rash, he was all taut skin and knobby bone. Three fingers of each hand were enclosed in open mesh tubes to the second knuckle, the tubes connected to a strap looped around the bed frame. The blemishes on his wrists were dark and cuff-shaped. Dr. Alvarez stood behind Martine.
The finger restraints have been effective in reducing his skin trauma. Any pressure causes blood to well up through the pores.
A stand beside the bed had been cleared in advance of his arrival, and he stepped over to it now, donning his stole, taking the candles out of his satchel. Checking that they were secure in theirs, he mounted the candles on the stand and lighted them with a match. From his berth, he extracted the picks containing the wafer and put it on the bedst in front of the candles. He covered this with the communion cloth and genuflected. He was walking back around to the bedstand when Colon went into a convulsion. All at once, his lips peeled back from his gums in a kind of rictus. The muscles of his neck and jaw began to quiver. He arched off the mattress, his right bringing up to mound the blanket, his foot thrashing from side to side like a captured animal. The spasms diminished after less than 30 seconds, his arm falling over the rail, dangling there limply for a moment, until the nurse came around to readjust it at his side. The priest leaned over the deathbed.
"Do you remember our discussions? We have had many of them, about many subjects, about faith and strength."
He thought he saw Colon's eyes twitch under their closed lids.
"Now we will ask God's grace and find renewed strength in our unity with his spirit, you and I together."
Alvarez stepped forward.
"Father, he is much too weak."
Martin shot a hand out behind his back and waved him into silence.
"Mi presidente, can you take communion?"
A moment passed. Colon's eyes flickered more rapidly, and then one of them opened and fastened on Martin. Its white was swimming in blood. Colon strained to answer, managed nothing more than a croak. The doctor protested.
"He mustn't be."
This time, Alvarez fell silent without any urging. Colon had declared his wish with a weak but unmistakable nod, his red eye never leaving Martin's face. Monterey Bay, California, November 6, 2001. Raleigh Thibodeau felt his tackle jerk hard as the giant sea bass erupted from the bay, its spiny dorsal fin raised like a mainsail, foam spraying off its mottled flanks. He braced himself, his feet planted apart, knowing he couldn't afford to give the fish any slack. Then something gave out inside him. His feet slipped forward over the Pomona's deck, and he saw the gunwale come closer. Vibrating like a bowstring across its entire length, the line snapped just behind the wire leader. Winded, his face red with exertion above his short brown beard, Thibodeau tossed his rod disgustedly to the planks and leaned over the rail.
"Damn! Goddamn!"
Megan Breen stared at his back for a few seconds, then shifted her eyes to Pete Nimick, over to her left. Both had raced up behind Thibodeau to cheer him on when the fish struck. She looked at him another moment in the crisp offshore breeze, a thumb hooked into the hip pocket of her Levi's, her thick auburn hair blowing over the shoulders of a tailored leather blouse. Then she shrugged and stepped closer to Thibodeau.
"It happens, Raleigh. Everybody has a story to tell about the one that got away."
He turned abruptly from the rail.
"No,"
he panted, shaking his head.
"Then I think I'll go below, pack away the damn rod, and enjoy the boss's luxury accommodations."
She nodded. Thibodeau bent to pick up the angling rod and then strode off across the 100-footer's deck, passing Nimick without a hint of acknowledgement. Nimick came to stand beside Megan.
"I've never seen him act like that before. You think it was his tug-of-war with the fish that got to him, or the one with Ricci at the meeting?"
She sighed, her gaze drifting toward the vessel's prow. "Speaking of our other global field supervisor, he appears to be in a mood of his own." Nimick turned to look, his serious face visible in profile. Tom Ricci stood gazing out over the water.
"I have to wonder if the cooperative arrangement we worked out for those two wasn't good chemistry."
"Almost 7 months down the road seems kind of late for us to second-guess our decision. We have to make it good."
She put a hand on each of Nimick's shoulders.
"Your guy?" your ball. Nimick let her aim him towards Ricci and shove him off. Tall, lean, and dark-haired, his angular features several sharp cuts of the chisel from Hansen, Ricci kept staring across the water through his sunglasses as Nimick approached.
The raging Cajun get over losing the big one?
Pete stood next to him, his arms crossed over the rail.
Didn't think you were paying attention.
Ricci remained still.
Old cop habit. I pay attention to everything.
Ricci hesitated, then slowly turned to face him.
I wasn't looking to get into it with Thibodeau at the meeting.
Nobody said you were. Ricci shook his head.
That's not the point. I don't need that kind of bullshit.
Nimick's expression was reflective.
Agreed. The question is how you choose to handle it.
Ricci stood in the breeze, his shirt sleeves flapping around his sinewy arms.
Everybody who was at the meeting, except for me, has been with Gordian for years. You've all got similar ideas about what S.W.O.R.D. ought to be. You're all used to sticking to certain operational guidelines. You develop them.
Sounds to me like you've already decided you don't fit. Ricci looked at him.
Come on, Pete. Tell me you don't have your doubts about what happened today.
Nimick thought about it. S.W.O.R.D. was the intelligence and security arm of his employer's globe-spanning corporation. Its title derived from a reference to the ancient legend of the Gordian Knot, which had defied every attempt at unraveling its complicated twists and turns until Alexander the Great cast subtlety aside and split it apart with a definitive stroke of his blade. This illustrated Roger Gordian's own no-nonsense attitude toward the modern-day problems that might jeopardize his interests, utilizing country-specific political and economic profiles to help anticipate the vast majority of them before they became full-blown crises, and tackling the unpredictable emergencies that cropped up to endanger uplink personnel with the most highly trained and well-equipped counter-threat force he could assemble. Every 12 months before the happy distractions of the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays kicked into high gear, Gordian gathered S.W.O.R.D.'s leadership aboard his yacht for a sort of informal year-end review and freewheeling blue-sky session. This year's roundtable, however, had produced less in the way of common understanding than acrimonious confrontation, at least between two of its key participants. Besides Nimick, Megan, Ricci, Thibodeau, and Gordian himself, it had been attended by Vince Scull, Uplink's chief risk assessment analyst, freshly returned from a long stint in the South Pacific, where he'd been scouting out locales for new satellite ground facilities. Discussion had followed across a range of subjects. How was the S.W.O.R.D. hiring drive in India going? In South Africa? What about those negotiations with Poland? And the possible ramifications of the sudden death of Bolivian president-elect Alberto Colón? The tragedy of it went beyond his youth. His humanitarian values and aggressive challenge to the mini-cartels had promised to spark a regional trend and led to preliminary talks with Uplink about joint commercial initiatives with his country. What were the prospects for those efforts without Colón at the young administration's helm? It was not by chance that they had waited until after their meal to bring up the previous spring's sabotage of a NASA space shuttle carrying uplink orbital technology and S.W.O.R.D.'s presumably connected encounters with paid terrorists in southern Brazil and Kazakhstan, the nasty affair to which Skull had alluded. A number of major issues surrounding those events had remained unresolved, and Gordian had wanted everything else on the agenda out of the way, so they could devote the latter half of the meeting to them without digression. He turned his penetrating blue eyes toward Raleigh Thibodeau.
Any progress to report?
Thibodeau pursed his lips.
Some got to do with Le Chat Sauvage.
Nimick would later recall seeing Ricci tense with something between edginess and anger at Thibodeau's mention of the tag he'd given the terrorist's otherwise nameless field commander, Cajun French for the Wildcat, a man who had twice eluded their efforts to capture him, the second time after tearing away from Ricci during a fierce hand-to-hand struggle at the Baikonur Cosmodrome.
Up till a few days ago, we didn't have anything would give us a firm lead on him. Was plenty for guesswork, though. Journalist in Peru got kidnapped and ransomed for $7 million back in 97. He say the guy calling the shots with the narco guerrillas who did the snatch was tall, blonde, and light-skinned. Body like a weightlifter. ordered him returned to his family, minus both eyes.
Gordian shook his head in horror.
Making a positive ID by the victim close to impossible if any of his abductors were ever captured. The cold-blooded logic, certainly.
Nimick spoke.
And he gets around. Remember the Air Paris flight that was hijacked in Morocco last year? This one has a silver lining, Gord. A French ambassador being held on board managed to get a photo of him when he wasn't paying attention.
Gordian had raised his eyebrows.
Did you actually see a copy of the photo?
Not then, I didn't. But thanks to Raleigh, I have.
Thibodeau minimized this accomplishment with a wave of his hand.
The ambassador ain't the only one has contacts. I called in an IOU with somebody in Europol who did the same with somebody else. Then, one morning last week, I turn on my computer, and there's the photo attached to an encrypted email. I forwarded the pair of them to Ricci, since he actually seen him up close.
Gordian glanced across the table at Ricci.
It's him, no question.
Gordian looked thoughtful. Thibodeau spoke.
Got another thing in the works. I asked to tap into Europol's database of known terrorists. I'm going to run every at-large, be a general match for Le Chat Sauvage, through that new profiler system the techie's been working on. See if we get any hits.
Nimick spoke. The software's designed to recognize suspects hiding behind full face masks or disguises, even ones who've had plastic surgery. By comparing digital file images with each other and a checklist of hard-to-alter physical characteristics. When it started to look like the Europeans might open up for Raleigh, Megan and I became mildly optimistic about getting some cooperation from domestic security agencies.
Gordian glanced at Megan. What about the FBI? Have you gotten in touch with Bob Lang in D.C.?
She nodded.
He's sympathetic to my request, and I seem to be making headway. We've arranged a face-to-face meeting for early next week.
That isn't close to good enough.
In retrospect, Nimick guessed Ricci's interruption had surprised him less than the fact that he hadn't spoken up much sooner. He'd been at constant odds with his colleagues over how the probe was being handled, and had expressed his unhappiness to Nimick on a multitude of occasions. Gordian turned toward Ricci, as had Nimick and everyone else in the room.
You believe we should be doing something different?
Ricci answered.
I think we need a special task force on the job 24/7. I think it should have a separate command center with the capability to send rapid deployment teams after the people that hit us in Kuyaba and the Russian launch site. They killed our people without provocation, and we've lost months that should have been spent running them down. We have to go on the offensive.
After a brief pause, Gordian looked around the table.
Anybody like to comment?
Thibodeau was quick to gesture that he did.
We gotta be realistic. By whose sanction are we gonna have armed search teams operate across borders?
Ricci spoke at once.
Our own?
Thibodeau frowned.
That might have washed when you was a city cop looking to hold some gangbangers off the street. But not when you got to abide by international rules of law. We can't be going anywhere we want, doing anything we please.
Ricci had fixed him with a sharp look.
Like when you got yourself shot to bits playing Wyatt Earp in Brazil, that right?
Thibodeau stiffened in his chair, glaring at Ricci with open resentment and hostility.
Knew plenty of tough guys in Nam. They either gave up their attitudes or choked on them.
Ricci said nothing in response. He sat absolutely still, his face impassive, his eyes locked on Thibodeau's. And here Nimick stood topside 2 hours later, Ricci beside him at the rail, both men staring into the blue distance. Nimick glanced over at him now.
Small steps. That's how you count your gains. Those words sound familiar?
Ricci didn't move for several seconds. Then he turned toward him, the faintest hint of a smile on his face.
I'll stick around, Pete. For now.
Nimick nodded, and this time it was his turn to smile a little.
That's about all I can ask.
A distancing from consequence salves the betrayer's guilt. Remove any act from a broader context, and one can become convinced it means nothing. Alone in Roger Gordian's office at Uplink in San Jose, Don Pallady told himself it was only a few hairs he was taking. White cotton gloves on his hands,
He stood behind Gordian's open desk drawer and used a tweezer to pull a strand from the comb in one of its neat compartments. He carefully dropped it into his Zip-It evidence collection bag, and then plucked two more from the teeth of the comb, dropping them into the plastic bag as well. As head of the sweep team that performed weekly electronic counter-surveillance checks in the building's executive offices and conference rooms, Pallardy had no concerns about being discovered in an awkward or compromising position. Alone and trusted here in the office, safe from surreptitious intercept, as it was known in the trade, Pallardy slid the evidence bag between his thumb and forefinger to seal it, dropped the bag into a patch pocket of his coveralls, and pushed the knee-hole drawer shut. Don Pallardy considered himself a decent and caring man, though not without human frailty. Had he found an expensive piece of jewelry on the carpet here, a missing cufflink or tie chip studded with diamonds, he would have returned it to his employer, regardless of how much taking it with him would have helped with his debts. All he had taken were a couple, three hairs. Since Brazil, he'd gotten very good at rationalizing away his transgressions. Baja Peninsula, Mexico, November 8, 2001. The tunnel was about 10 feet deep and ran for 2 miles toward the United States under the sagebrush desert midway between Tijuana and Mexicali. Its southern opening was accessible through a trap door in the rear of a barnyard storage shed. Its northern opening was a small cleft in the hillside at the bottom of an arroyo within eyeshot of the California border. Tonight, some 30 yards from the tunnel's northern entrance, a dozen men were positioned on sandstone ledges along the east and west walls of the gulch. On the outcropping nearest the tunnel mouth was a wiry, dark-skinned young man with a neat little chin beard and coal-colored hair swept straight back from his forehead. He stood flattened against the slope in a toss of shadows cast by the dim light of a quarter moon. Higher up on the arroyo's western slope, Lathrop crouched behind a wide slab of rim rock, his mouth slightly open, his upper lip curled back, almost seeming to sniff the air as he watched the men below with intense fixation. It was an attitude queerly resembling the Flamin reaction in cats, the detection of airborne trace molecules with the Jacobson's organ, a tiny, exceedingly acute sensory receptor in the roof of the mouth that, like the tailbone, remains vestigial in humans and whose function is something between smell and taste, endowing the feline with what is often taken for a sixth sense. Calm, motionless, wholly focused in on his surveillance of those below, Lathrop watched from his solitary position of concealment. Peering into the eyepiece of his miniature DVD camcorder, Lathrop switched it to photo mode and made a minor adjustment to the night vision scope coupled to its lens. He whispered under his breath, "Okay, Cousin Felix, let's do it with feeling." Felix Quiros had been patient. Resisting any impulse to act prematurely, he had waited for several breathless moments until he was positive that the entire shipment of heroin had been carried out, before he reached a hand down to the radio detonator's transmitter unit on the ledge beside him. Then, with a quick tug on its antenna to be certain it was fully extended, he flipped the device's firing switch. Inside the tunnel, its receiver sent a jolt of current through the wires leading to the multiple TNT satchel charges that Quiros and his men had planted along the final yards of the passage, covering them from sight with stones and loose earth. The explosion was virtually instantaneous. It clapped and rolled through the arroyo, shaking its very walls, a fantastic claw of flame and smoke lashing from the tunnel's entrance. Felix aimed his bullpup, fanning his weapon from side to side, even as his men did the same from their own perches. Screaming in pain and terror, the helpless young mules were cut down where they stood, some crawling on the ground under their bulky loads in futile attempts to reach cover. Meanwhile, the handful of stunned forzadores, who remained on their feet, had begun blindly triggering their own weapons at the outcrops. But they were easy, exposed targets for the scissoring barrage from the ambush positions. The slaughter had taken less than 10 minutes from beginning to end. Lathrop kept recording for a while longer, wanting to catch a scene of Felix and his men as they descended into the arroyo for the skag. They worked fast, cutting the straps of the dead courier's bundles with folding knives, then tearing them from their backs and gathering them into a single huge mound. While this was going on, a few of Felix's hombres split off from the rest and went scrambling toward the north end of the gulch, presumably to bring the vehicles they'd used to haul away their score. Lathrop considered waiting for them to return, maybe taking a shot of them in the process of loading up, but rejected the idea almost immediately. He'd got Felix hands down for the killings and the snatch, got what he needed from A to Z. Carefully detaching the night scope from his camcorder, Lathrop put both back into their cases, shouldered his weapons, and silently retreated into the darkness. Various locales, November 11, 2001. Some months earlier in Madrid, in the Museo del Prado, he had gone to view Bruegel the Elder's painting, The Triumph of Death. It was as if time had stilled around him, as if his innermost visions had been projected onto the wall of the gallery. He had not known where to rest his eye. On the molten orange landscape with its pools of fire, its spewing clouds of black volcanic smoke, or the medieval village besieged by an exterminating army of skeletons, banners of war, hoisted above their skull heads, the hollow sockets of their eyes showing only a pitiless adherence to their single objective. Here they hacked at the living with broadswords. Here they impaled them on the points of spears. There a cadaverous looter knelt over his stripped victim, holding knife to throat to deliver the finishing stroke. Where to rest the eye? On which scene of fabulous annihilation? Until that unforgettable experience, Siegfried Kuehl had never been moved by a work of art. He had gone to the museum out of curiosity and nothing more, compelled by Harlan Devane's remark that he might find it of interest. 6 months ago it had been, after the debacle in Kazakhstan, where only a chance diversion had allowed him to break on the sword operative with whom he'd grappled in the launch center's cargo processing facility. The man's features were framed in his mind in photographic detail. Whenever he pictured the sharply angular jut of his cheekbones, the set of his mouth, he would feel the restless desire for vengeance slide coldly through his intestines. And he felt it now, 6 months later and a continent away, sitting at a window table in a brasserie called La Pistou, opposite the Champ de Bataille Park in Quebec City. Kuehl's failure at the Cosmodrome had been a severe blow. Driven underground, wishing to get far ahead of his pursuers, he had altered his appearance, obtaining colored contact lenses, darkening his hair, filling out his lips with collagen injections, even growing a short beard. He looked out the window and saw her emerge from the park, his lovely pale rider, punctual as always, crossing the Grande Allée to the Brasserie, her blonde hair tossing in the wind, the collar of her dark, knee-length coat pulled up around her neck against the inclement weather. She spotted him from outside on the sidewalk, their eyes making contact through the window, a smile tracing at her lips. She entered the restaurant and strode directly toward his table, walking ahead of the punctilious maitre d', who approached her at the door, motioning to indicate she'd already found her party. "Did you have a pleasant trip?"
"Yes."
"And your lodging?"
"It's fine," she said. "I've missed you."
He nodded silently. She turned her wine glass in her hands.
"Will you be joining me at the hotel tonight?"
He leaned slightly forward over the table.
"I leave Quebec before sundown, and your flight to the States is scheduled for early tomorrow morning."
She hesitated.
"There have been so many flights lately."
He met her gaze.
"We will be together very soon, but dictates."
She lowered her eyes to her glass. After a few seconds, she looked back up at him.
"I understand."
Kuehl nodded and reached into the inside pocket of his sport coat, producing a black enameled gift box of the sort that might hold a bracelet, along with a small card envelope of the same color. He held both out to her across the table.
In San Diego, you will be meeting with someone named Enrique Quiros. The note I've written in the card will tell you the rest.
She nodded with understanding and carefully placed the box and envelope into her purse. The fingers of Lucio Salazar's right hand dug into the arm of his fleecy burgundy sofa. His other hand held the last of the digital prints Lathrop had given him to scrutinize, the rest of the infrared photos on the coffee table in front of him.
"How long you been sitting on this?"
Lathrop answered Salazar's question with one of his own.
"What do you mean? Your load was grabbed last night. I'm here today."
Salazar looked at him. He was a large man in his late 30s, wearing a cream-colored tropical suit, a pale blue shirt open at the collar, and tan Gucci loafers. There was a Rolex with an enormous diamond-crusted gold band on his right hand, a diamond ring on his left pinky, a diamond stud in his right earlobe. A gold figure of some saint or other hung from a chain around his thick neck.
"I was asking when you found out these fucking Marigones were going to make a move on me. If I had known sooner, I would have been able to do something about it."
Lathrop's expression was calmly businesslike. He leaned forward and tapped one of the snapshots on the coffee table with his finger. It showed Felix Quiros and his men cutting the knapsacks off the backs of Salazar's massacred Indian couriers outside the smoking ruin of the tunnel entrance.
"I get a tip, I check it out before coming to you with it. That's quality, Lucio, and it's what I provide."
After perhaps 20 seconds, Salazar leaned forward over the table and studied another of the pictures, his eyebrows knitted in brooding thought, slowly shaking his head from side to side as he recognized the body of the coyote.
"El muerto nada se lleva y todo se acaba."
The dead take nothing with them and everything comes to an end. He glanced back up at Lathrop.
"You know if Felix was being stupid on his own, or does the stupidity go up the line?"
Lathrop prepared to stir in the lie.
"Felix? Come on, he might have his boys glom car computers, shake down bodega owners, nickel-dime stuff on his own string.
But his big cousins are just letting him run off the leash, so he feels a player instead of a punk. And even Felix isn't brainless enough not to realize how far to take it before he smacks into a brick wall. What happened at the tunnel, he'd never in his miserable life try it without their endorsement." Lathrop watched the thought lines on Salazar's forehead deepen. He was seething, and with very good reason. In tight with the old-line South American growers and processors from the days when his father headed the clan, Lucio's organization had been smuggling contraband across the U.S.-Mexico border for over half a century. The Quiroses were way down the hierarchy, and until recently hadn't done anything to challenge the Salazar Empire, sticking to a relatively insignificant share of the coke market. New drug money, you might call them. But since they'd gotten tied in with El Tio's network a year or so back, there had been signs they were looking to make inroads into Salazar's territory. Salazar was still shaking his head with combined anger and dismay.
"I can't accept this. You find out how the Quiroses knew when my shipment was coming. Anything else about their setup, I'll give you my word of honor, it'll be worth a jackpot."
Lathrop nodded, making an effort not to smile. Next stop on the road, Enrique Quiros. California, November 12, 2001. Every day it was the same for the whole day. Employment applications, personnel evaluations, and equipment requisitions were spilling from his overloaded inbox like tenants from a collapsing high-rise. 6 months after his elevation to the post of global field supervisor, Raleigh Thibodeau had still to feel any balance between the continuous supervisory and administrative demands of an organization as large as SWORD and his personal capacity to fulfill them. Shrugging, Thibodeau reached into his breast pocket and pulled a satiny Monte Cristo No. 2 from a two-finger leather case. And then there was Tom Ricci, one of the most galling, cocksure bastards he'd ever met. Thibodeau hated sharing the job with him, and to compound matters, was angered over the position he'd just been put in because of him. On a trial basis, Pete Nemec had qualified when soliciting his approval. With constant oversight. Now he clipped the end of the cigar with his Swiss Army knife, foregoing the expensive double-blade guillotine cutter he'd received as a fare-thee-well from his crew in Brazil. Thibodeau struck a match and lit up, carefully holding the tip of the cigar at the edge of the flame, turning it in his hand until it caught all the way around. Then he raised the cigar to his mouth and smoked. Looking across his desk at the empty chair where Nimick had sat only minutes before, Thibodeau again recalled his limber, pitching style, so reminiscent of Megan's approach that he'd wondered if she had been offering pointers. Nimick relayed the news that Gordian and the others had come down in favor of establishing a rapid deployment team section. "We proceed either unanimously or not at all. Decision this important, it's got to have your support." Thibodeau's reply was blunt.
"Say I ain't willing. What then?"
Nimick had looked him straight in the eye.
"Then I walk out of here and into Gord's office and report that the plan's DOA. I said unanimous, and I meant it." "And where's Tom Ricci fit into the plan? What's he supposed to do while I'm cooking up strategy?"
Nimick had seemed prepared for the question.
"My idea is for Ricci to concentrate on tactical issues and on training, the fields where his talents would be best applied and where he's most at home."
Nimick had moved forward in the chair opposite him, his hands on the edge of the desk, his gaze unwavering. Thibodeau waited another few seconds to answer, then expelled a relenting sigh.
"Go ahead and count me in. But I got my doubts, mighty ones. This ain't nothing between me and you, but I want my feelings on record."
Nimick responded with a quick nod. Thibodeau snapped back to the present, puffing on his Monte Cristo. He pushed himself out of his chair, feeling a sudden need to get out from behind the desk. He was standing in front of his desk, staring at his heaping inbox, staring at it with eyes that burned fiercely with anger and frustration.
"Ricci. Tactical issues. Fields where he's most at home."
His hand shot out with sudden violence, sweeping the inbox off his desktop. It struck the wall with a crash, papers spilling from it, hitting the floor. And then he got hold of himself. The red haze of anger peeled from his vision to leave him looking at the strew of forms and documents that had flown from the overturned box, his expression marveling and horrified, hardly able to believe his eyes. What had he done? What in God's name was wrong with him? Thibodeau stood there as if waiting for an answer. When it didn't come after a long while, he knelt and slowly began gathering the papers off the floor. In his navy blue blazer, olive golf shirt, and dark khaki slacks, Enrique Quiros might have been a particular brand of contemporary executive. Ivy League, 30-ish, perhaps the founder of some internet-based corporation. The cut of his wavy black hair was short, neat, and unfussy. His slender build was that of a careful eater and dedicated exerciser. The prismatic lettering on the door of his third-floor office suite in downtown San Diego read, "Golden Triangle Services," a corporate name apparently referring to the area northeast of La Jolla, where it was clustered in among many of the city's upstart high-tech businesses. The office decor was bright and open, with smooth plexiglass surfaces, beige carpeting, some muted abstract prints on the walls, and a spacious conference corner, where a pair of his bodyguards now sat on a raw sienna leather sofa, looking respectable and respectful, eyeing Quiros's visitor indirectly, as feral wolves might, to signal cautious non-aggression. The slight bulges of the firearms hidden under their suit jackets would have been unnoticeable to the average observer, but Lathrop had discerned them immediately as he arrived for his appointment.
"Nice new office, Enrique. You're moving up."
Quiros smiled and indicated the chair opposite him. Lathrop sat. He could remember when Enrique's speech had been thickly accented with what they called Spanglish on the peninsula.
This was before he had gone off to school, when his father was still alive and running the operation. Kido shrugged his wristwatch from under the sleeve of his jacket and checked the time.
You called just at the right moment, Lathrop. A half hour later, and I'd have already left for an appointment.
I won't be long.
Frankly, I was surprised to hear from you at all. You've been doing a lot of work for the Salazars, and it made me wonder if you'd chosen to give up your independence for steady employment.
Lathrop shook his head.
Freelance is more enjoyable. Make your own rules. Don't have to ration your sick days.
Kiddos looked at him.
What do you have for me?
Information more valuable than Matanyan. Took a moment to review the latest modification of his storyline. It was becoming a little complicated, and he needed to stay on his toes.
3 nights ago, your nephew Felix and his friends grabbed a shipment the Salazars were bringing up from Mexico. I'm talking 60 kilos, maybe more. A major load. Took out a bunch of Salazar's people and cut up a few of them to send him a message.
Kiddos had immediately begun shaking his head in denial.
You've got to be mistaken. Felix has been troublesome in the past, but doing something like that isn't in him.
Lathrop shrugged mildly.
Since you started running with the top dog in South America, word from my sources is Felix has been acting like he's untouchable. When he got tipped off about the product that was being mulled over, it hyped him up to where he couldn't resist pissing in the Salazar's front yard to mark territory.
What are you saying? That knowing I'd be opposed to an action that rash, Felix went ahead and moved without my consent? Lathrop nodded.
So you wouldn't interfere.
Kiddos was still trying to push off acceptance.
Felix is impulsive and sometimes acts in ways that aren't very smart, but he has enough sense to realize I'd found out about the theft. If you're suggesting he didn't tell me because he means to keep the profits to himself...
You didn't hear me say that, Enrique. Maybe he figures to make a quick turnover on the product, impress you with a surprise jackpot. All I know is he did this thing. Kiddos was frowning unhappily. Lathrop prepared to cinch his knot of deception.
Felix made a mess at the scene of the ripoff, but from what I hear, one of Salazar's men lived long enough afterward to tell who was responsible. Lucio holds you personally to blame. He can't see Felix having the cojones to go ahead with something this heavy without you ordering it, or at least giving it your blessing.
Visibly agitated, Kiddos didn't say a word for perhaps a full minute. Lathrop waited. He was sure now that Enrique had bought his story and could practically visualize the question forming in his mind.
I'd like to find out how Felix learned about the shipment. Do you have anything on that?
Lathrop shook his head no, convincingly. You want me to do the research?
It would be helpful.
Kiddos abruptly checked his watch again and straightened.
We'd better put a wrap on this. I have to be going.
Lathrop tilted back a little, the hinges of his jaw relaxing, his lips parting as if to taste the air. Upset as Enrique had been a second ago, he'd managed to compose himself. But the way he'd almost jumped from his seat when he looked at his watch seemed very peculiar. If the appointment he'd remembered was pressing enough to cut their business short, given the significance of what they'd been talking about, well, it would have to be pretty important itself, wouldn't it? Careful not to appear the least bit curious, Lathrop stood, told Kiddos he'd be in touch, then turned and walked past the two bodyguards in the conference area and left the office. Various locales, November 2001. He moved between the joggers and strollers on the path leading around the carousel in Balboa Park. Lathrop remembered reading somewhere that in French, carousel meant tournament, while the Italian word carocello translated to little war, giving origin to the English carousel. Now Lathrop slowed to a halt at the edge of the path. He had a good view of the carousel from where he stood, and he didn't need to get any closer. Lathrop bent as if to tie his shoelaces and gazed covertly at the spinning platform through the lightweight, black-framed eyeglasses he'd donned in his car. An instant later, he pushed a tiny knob at the hinge of their left stem with his fingertip, and a rectangular augmented reality panel appeared on that side.
seeming to hover about 2 feet in front of him. The AR display was in fact being projected onto the upper half of the plain plastic lens by the micro-electromechanical, or MEMS, optical systems embedded in the frame of the glasses. A twist of the control knob focused the image reflector magnifiers in the lens and smoothed the display's borders.
"Profiler,"
Lathrop whispered into the pickup mic clipped to his collar. On his vocal command, an audio link through a slender cable running down under his windbreaker to his hidden wearable computer launched a bootleg version of the Uplink International face-finding application, sold to him by Enrique Quiros. Talk about an intriguing turn of the wheel. Lathrop waited as the software loaded. To conserve memory, he'd installed a minimized version that contained a search index of 10,000 terrorists, criminals, and their known associates, and would show the 20 closest matches in the AR panel. The program's full option setup on his desktop computer would have let him scan many times that number, and Lathrop knew he could have accessed its database resources over his wireless network connection. But that was a time-consuming distraction in the field, and the pinhole digicam in the bridge of his glasses would capture an image of his subject that he could review at his convenience. Estimating he had about a minute to fiddle with his sneakers without attracting attention, Lathrop concentrated on the twosome sitting like sweethearts in a gondola at the perimeter of the carousel. The man was Enrique Quiros. Lathrop didn't recognize the blonde looker riding with him, but he'd been on enough tales in his day to read their body language and was positive that whatever was going on here was strictly business. Now he watched them circle around and around, talking rapidly, as if trying to cram in whatever had to be said before the 5-minute ride came to a finish. Lathrop was hoping he'd be able to piece together their conversation on playback, using the speech-reading component of his desktop software, which employed context-sensitive logic to fill in sequential blank spots when their faces spun away from his digicam lens, or the carousel's movement blurred the video input, also compensating to some extent for the crosstalk that occurred during ordinary verbal exchanges. As the carousel whirled on, the profiler floated a dozen possible hits, overlaying the bottom of the mugshots with their known or assumed names, ages, nationalities, and a requisite listing of offenses. Lathrop was mildly disappointed. He'd have liked to ID the blonde on sight, but it was clear she wasn't any of the criminal candidates that had popped into his display. He straightened, figuring he'd bent over his shoelace long enough. Lathrop was about to move on down the path when he noticed something that caused him to risk staying put another few seconds. As the gondola spun past on one of its final slow revolutions, Blondie abruptly opened her purse, brought out a smallish object, and gave it to Enrique. A box, dark and shiny, the kind Lathrop imagined they'd carry in those exclusive Rodeo Drive jewelry stores. Enrique looked reluctant to accept the box, almost nervous, stuffing it into the pocket of his sport jacket like it was red hot to the touch. Lathrop's chin tilted upward. His lips parted and curled. He drew in a breath. Exit profiler, run video. Another two voice commands and the scene was replayed on his eyeglass display. And to think a few seconds ago, he'd felt let down. Lathrop turned from the carousel and took the walkway back toward the parking lot. On the books, Felix Quiros earned his bread from the family-owned automobile salvage business he managed on the outskirts of San Diego. But his veal was in the money he made shipping various hot American vehicles to countries throughout the world via Mexico. The less desired vehicles were dismantled for parts in Felix's chop shop.
"So, when I gonna find out why you got me rattling my stones instead of us meeting inside where it'd be nice and warm?"
Felix stood there with Lathrop amid the rows of gutted and flattened vehicles. He hugged himself for warmth, rubbing his hands briskly over his shoulders.
"What the fuck's this about?"
Lathrop looked at him.
"You have a fresh mouth, sonny. Ought to consider finishing school. It did wonders for Enrique. Who's the reason I'm here?"
Felix made an unsatisfactory attempt at minimizing how much that piqued his interest.
ain't got to be disrespectful. And what's up with my uncle, anyway?
As far as you're concerned, as I met with him today, and he happened to mention that he's upset about you moving on Salazar without his nod. Felix struck a posture of bluff rejection, lifted straight from some MTV hip-hop video. Head pulled back, chest thrust forward.
How'd he find out I got anything to do with that? And why he want to talk to you about it?
Lathrop released a deep breath. You didn't hear me say our meeting was about you. Enrique made a comment, and I figured you might want to know what it was. Far as who clued him, it's you did the hijack. I don't have the foggiest idea. Maybe you opened that big show-off's mouth of yours to somebody with an even bigger one. Felix shook his head rapidly.
No way, no way. Besides, if Enrique is in a burn about this, how come you didn't put in a good word? You the man told me when Salazar's shipment was coming. You the man told me Enrique wouldn't have faith I could do the job. Told me to keep it under the fucking table till after the product's turned over. Split the earnings with him afterward and finally get him to recognize me. You the man, Lathrop.
I gave you my best advice before. Figured I'd give it now. No extra charge. Go, talk to Enrique. Tell him the truth. Be clear you weren't intending to hold out on him. Just omit the fact it was me who put you onto the shipment. Felix tossed his head and did a kind of petulant shuffle, kicking the toe of his shoe into the dirt.
Omit, right. How I know it wasn't you gave me up to my uncle?
Felix suddenly became still, swallowed, his expression showing an awareness that he really had opened his mouth too wide this time. The silenced Glock 9 appeared in Lathrop's hand as if he'd snatched it out of nowhere. He brought up the pistol and squeezed the trigger twice, putting two slugs into the precise center of Felix's forehead before he knew what hit him. 10 minutes later, Lathrop slipped out of the salvage yard unnoticed, anxious to get back home. Tired as he was, he meant to take a closer look at the videos he'd taken of Uncle Enrique and Blondie on the carousel. Not to mention that his cats needed feeding and a little tender loving care before he fell into bed, the three of them having been left alone since very early that morning. Various locales, November 6, 2001. Margaret Renee Duquette lived alone in a three-story ancestral townhouse in the heart of New Orleans, attended by her servant of long years, an aging Creole woman named Alyssa, who occupied the detached slave quarters out back. Margaret Renee's son, christened Jean David after her father, had seemed a normal, if colicky, infant for the first 6 months of his life. When he was 10 months old, Margaret Renee noticed an odd jerkiness to his movements and a gradual loss of previously acquired physical skills. In precautionary tones, the child's doctors had recommended a blood sample be taken and sent to a laboratory specializing in the detection of lysosomal disorders, a term unfamiliar to Margaret Renee and her husband until then, broadly explained to characterize a range of defects in a type of cellular membrane. The final diagnosis was devastating. Jean David was found to have globoid cell leukodystrophy, or Krabbe's disease, a rare genetic disorder transmitted by a pair of carrier parents. For Jean David, the slippage was rapid. As his first birthday approached, the breakdown of his motor system led to paralysis and near blindness. He soon lost the ability to take solid foods and had to be nourished through intubation. As the pressures of coping with Jean David's steady decline had escalated in her, Margaret Renee had tried reaching out to her husband for support. But his private suffering had plunged him into his own downhill slide. He became uncommunicative and began drinking heavily. Finally, Jean David developed a severe case of pneumonia, from which he was not expected to recover. By then, Margaret Renee's anguished prayers at his cribside were no longer for a miracle to spare him, but for God to put an end to his ordeal, to grant him a compassionate surcease. Her pleas went unanswered. Jean David lingered for weeks. He was just 16 months old when he passed away. Margaret Renee's marriage survived him by less than a year. This was 10 years ago. Margaret Renee rarely went outside, leaving Alyssa to order the groceries and take care of her various needs. Margaret Renee did not, however, consider herself to be uninvolved with the world. Her parents had entrusted her with guardianship of their financial wealth, amassed over generations, and the inheritance had to be monitored and protected. Old money kept old secrets, some quite dark. Margaret Renee had always understood this, as had her parents and their parents. Shunning direct personal interaction, ill at ease on the telephone, she had purchased a desktop computer, and quickly becoming proficient with it, would routinely attend to her correspondences over the Internet. Margaret Renee sat staring at her computer display now, open-mouthed. Just minutes ago, she had completed her usual log-on to the proxy server and noticed that a ciphertext email had arrived. Instantly, her eyes had widened. She had provided only a single person with the digital key code that would allow him to send a message to her via the anonymous account. A facilitator of matchless capabilities, with whom both her father and her former husband had dealings. Her hand shaking with excitement, she typed in her decryption key. The email simply read, "Awaken the sleeper. Fee, 50 million. Instructions to follow within 1 week." Perhaps a year before, in a private chat room over an encrypted link, the originator of the current message had posed a question to which she'd replied with complete straightforwardness, although interpreting it as a mere hypothetical. She could recall their exchange verbatim. "What would you give to terminate all children with leukodystrophies while they were still in the womb?"
"I would give anything."
"And if it meant the death of the carrier parents?"
"That would be for the best."
"And if it meant your own death as well?"
"Better still."
Months passed before stunning of the sleeper project had arrived in the form of an email attachment. Reading it with a mixture of eagerness and incredulity, Margaret Renee had at last understood what he had been leading toward in his prior communication. Her thin face bathed in the ghostly radiance of the computer screen, her heart thumping in her chest, Margaret Renee felt as if she were poised on the threshold of a dream. "Awaken the sleeper. Fee, 50 million. Instructions to follow within 1 week." As Arif Alashar, the Sudanese Minister of the Interior, sat reading the email attachment on his computer screen, his thoughts immediately took the shape of an unambiguous proverb. "In any vital activity, it is the path that matters." For decades, his government in Khartoum had been engaged in civil war with rebels in the nation's south, their opposition fanned by Dinka tribesmen of black African origin, who had resisted acceptance of Sharia, the strict Islamic code of law and conduct imposed after the revolution. The Dinkas had formed an alliance with the Nuer, a bordering tribe with whom they shared and often feuded over livestock, areas, and water resources in the riverine plains around the White Nile. In spite of Khartoum's efforts to impose order, the rebels persisted in their defiance. Weary from decades of struggle and natural disaster, facing a re-solidified insurgent movement that was liable to keep the fighting at an impasse, torn by rifts between religious conservatives and secular reformers in its own parliament, Khartoum had capitulated to mounting demands and entered into a peace dialogue with the rebels, the stated agenda of which was to grant the southern provinces an as-yet-unspecified level of self-determination. Displeased with the government's acquiescence, Arif Ashar and a small group of his fellow conservatives had at that juncture committed to secretly hunting for a more palatable alternative. Arif Alashar himself had contacted a one-stop provider of black market arms, technology, and mission personnel with whom he'd had a long-standing affiliation, and the upshot was the message that had just appeared, then dissolved on his computer display. Now the question for Alashar remained: which shining path to take? Without official government approval, funds for his venture would have to be secured through clandestine means, and there were limitations to what could be funneled from existing budgetary appropriations before the drain became noticeable. The wealthier members of Alashar's parliamentary cabal were certain to pledge additional monies, but the product's high price tag was still restrictive, and hard choices needed to be made. For the moment, Al-Ashar would relish his sense of wide-open possibility, of roads that glowed with their own bright silvery light stretching out to even brighter crossings yet unglimpsed. Wherever it led him, the journey was going to be memorable. Nation codename, Cape Green, November 6, 2001. He had checked into the hotel 5 days ago and would need to stay perhaps another two before the diamonds for weapons deal was concluded. A man of rigorous discipline, he preferred sticking to a tight routine. Every morning since his arrival, he had taken a swim in the indoor pool at 6 o'clock, a time when few others were outside their rooms, and he stood the best chance of having it to himself. Today, he had reached the locker room and encountered undesired company. Habitually alert, he whisked his eyes over the men inside. Both were fit and in their mid-30s. One had blonde hair, the other brown. They were wearing workout clothes and speaking American English to each other, with the easy familiarity of close friends or associates. The blonde-haired man had a somewhat tousled appearance and a light growth of beard. As he stood inside the entryway, the men gave him mannerly nods. He noted them without response and went to the nearest free locker to the door, an ear attuned to their conversation.
"The taxi's around here, Jesus. That ride from the airport gave me bruises where I sit. Plus, he must just miss getting us crunched at least twice."
This was said to the man with the 24-hour stubble. He yawned.
"Thought I'd never make it to the conference."
The one on the bench looked amused.
"Usual advice. Taking a metered cab. Their drivers have to be licensed, and they carry identity cards. Like that's going to do you any good? Or you really think the insurance companies pay off around here, assuming they have insurance companies?"
The bristle-cheeked man grinned and reached inside the locker to adjust his trousers on the hook. The other's hand was returning to his bag. Without letting another instant pass, the morning swimmer abruptly abandoned his locker and strode back out the door. The pair in the room exchanged glances. His hand coming out of the gym bag with a .22 NAA Black Widow, the man on the bench sprang to his feet and slipped the 5-shot mini-revolver into the belly band under his sweatshirt. The stud simultaneously turned from his open locker, leaving its door flung wide. From his trouser pocket, he'd removed a holstered Beretta 950 BS semi-automatic, his own choice of a peekaboo gun. He stuffed the deep concealment holster into the pocket of his loosely fitting workout pants. They split off in opposite directions, each using restraint to keep from moving too quickly. Reaching the bank of three elevators, the brown-haired man glanced at the floor indicators above their doors. The numbers over the first and last cars were dark. The second elevator in line was descending. The number 11 and down arrow lit up. The elevator stopped at the fourth floor and its indicator light blinked off. He frowned, looked down the hall at his partner, shook his head.
Shit.
The wildcat had retreated to his den. The blond man spoke into his handheld radio.
"I can't figure out where we slipped up. 1 minute he's walking through the door, heading toward a locker, then he just takes off, in and out."
Tom Ricci spoke into his communications headset.
"Never mind."
He'd heard the locker room banter through installed surveillance mics and thought the slip-up was evident. There was an impenetrable tunnel of silence over the radio. Then,
"How do you want us to proceed?"
Ricci took a breath. Along with a couple of snoop techs named Gallagher and Thompson, he was across the street from the hotel in an office hastily rented through a cutout and used as a spy post for the past several days.
"Stay at the hotel. You'll hear from me."
More silence. The blond man at the other end of the trunked connection understood what Ricci's order meant. He and his buddy were finished, removed from the action, and soon to be cut loose from the fledgling RDT. Ricci aborted contact and passed Thompson's headset back to him. The bungled opportunity at the hotel meant things were about to get a lot more difficult for him and the rest of his task force. They had maintained a constant watch on Le Chat Sauvage, the wildcat, almost from the moment the terrorist arrived in the country, acting on reliable word from a plant among Antoine Aubin's inner circle. Antoine Aubin, the capital's top cop, was a crooked, venal son of a bitch who exercised his power in shameless cahoots with bands of catch-you-ing thieves and looters. And most significantly, the Wildcat was in the city at his direct invitation, enjoying the protective graces of the police and criminal militias that obey commanded with equal impunity. It was a difficult and potentially ugly situation for Ricci and his men. Thompson had turned to him from the multiplex transmitter. "What's next?" Ricci leaned back in his chair. The answer to that question depended on his assessment of what the Wildcat had or had not come to suspect, and, moreover, what his degree of suspicion might be. Had the topic of conversation in the locker room been the weather or hotel food? Had the two men inside been exchanging war stories about fatherhood, home repairs, deadlines, simple stuff? Chances were that the Wildcat would have hardly paid attention to them, and they'd have been able to make their intended move on him as he got ready for his swim. But instead, they chose to gripe about the local taxi service, and that had seemed unconvincing, even to Ricci. An American traveling to this country for a business conference, staying in an expensive first-class hotel, was no small potato with whatever firm he represented. It was far more likely than not that a courtesy car would be waiting for him at the airline terminal, and that the driver engaged by his corporate hosts would treat him like royalty. Okay, then. The two men's small talk had struck a false note, and their quarry had been sensitive to it. Ricci stared at the ceiling and thought in silence a while longer. Then he sat forward, looked at Thompson and Gallagher.
"We're shifting to our fallback options. Let's have the intercept teams keep close tabs on the airport and other departure routes just in case. But five gets you ten, our guy isn't going anywhere before he pays Obeng another visit."
It was late afternoon when Le Chat Sauvage appeared. Two of his bodyguards had preceded him out of the hotel, looking up and down the street, scouting for any indication of a threat. Then one of them made a discreet, all-clear gesture with his hand, and the Wildcat emerged onto the sidewalk, another couple of guards trailing a few steps behind. Minutes earlier, a line of five police vehicles had arrived at the entrance, two standard patrol cars followed by a diesel-fueled South African Lion 1, reinforced from frame to engine block with ballistic and blast-resistant carbon fiber monocoque. Behind drawn shades in the office across the street, Ricci and his techs watched on an LCD panel as the motorcade pulled into the two-way avenue bisecting the downtown area and then rolled eastward. The pictures feeding from 180-degree trackable spy eyes suctioned to the window pane. Ricci glanced at the city map on the wall above the monitoring station. East was toward police headquarters, Obeng's official seat of corruption, its location circled on the map with a red highlighter. His unofficial cradle lay west of the downtown area. Ricci had penned the words, "Gang Central Station," above the blue circle that marked its coordinates. Something wasn't kosher about what he'd just observed.
"Alert the strike team at Gang Central that company's on its way."
Thompson spun around in his chair and looked at him.
"Will do."
His eyes went to the wall map. "But," Ricci interrupted.
"I can read that as well as you. The whole scene in front of the hotel was a dupe, like a game of three-card Monty. Soon as Wildcat reaches police HQ, he's out the back door and into a different vehicle. We'll keep one of the tail cars on him. Let's have the others sit outside the cop station, make themselves just conspicuous enough so our man feels comfortable he's outsmarted us."
Comprehension dawned on Thompson's face. Ricci chewed the inside of his mouth, still thinking hard, making sure he'd covered all his bases. As he sloshed through a foul-smelling drainage culvert in a near squat, his boots awash in brown sludge, Ricci knew the worst things that could go wrong with his maneuver would be innocent civilians taken hostage, injured, or, even more unthinkable to him, killed during its execution. But Ricci had come a long way to collar the Wildcat, stalked him with all the resources at his disposal, and he was not going to succeed by knocking on Obeng's front door and politely asking that his guest step into the waiting arms of justice. As expected, the Wildcat's ride to the police station had been a classic casino shuffle. Soon after arriving there, he left in different clothes than he'd worn out of the hotel, and was then chauffeured off in the passenger seat of an unmarked sedan that pulled into the Crosstown Avenue's westbound lanes and clanked along seemingly on two cylinders, an authentic touch that allowed it to blend nicely with the crumpled matchboxes driven by the average motorists in this land of plenty. 30 minutes later, that car swung into the parking garage at Gang Central. Ricci and his strike team had been ready and waiting in the swampy, weed-clogged field out back. Cramped from kneeling, Ricci led the way through the narrow drainage duct for another 10 minutes. He raised a clenched fist to signal a pause, then glanced over his shoulder at Grillo. Drops maybe a yard. Grillo nodded and passed the word to Lou Rosander, the man behind him, who in turn relayed it to the next in line. With another crisp hand signal, Ricci turned toward the dark hole of the tunnel entrance to his immediate left and stepped into it, his feet squishing in the muck. His men followed without hesitation. Rosander peered through a thin fiber-optic periscope that he'd coiled upward through the metal drain cover above him.
Okay, I see a single attendant. I don't think he's one of Obeng's goons, or that he's going to be a problem.
Ricci pressed the thin patch of C2 explosive, a compound as powerful as C4, but more stable, against the ceiling surface until it was firmly secured. Then he took the lipstick detonator caps out of a separate pouch and inserted them. Before blowing their mouse hole into the sunken garage, his team would back through the runoff duct to keep a safe distance from the blast and falling masonry. Ricci got his radio out of its case on his belt. While the explosion he was setting off would be small and contained, any explosion was by definition noisy, and therefore would be heard by those in the building unless masked. Ricci had arranged for something even noisier to do just that. A few blocks east on the Crosstown Avenue, two men in the white uniforms of emergency medical responders had been waiting patiently in the cab of a double-parked ambulance. After receiving Ricci's cue, the driver cut the radio and turned to his partner. We're on. They raced into traffic toward Gang Central, the ambulance's light bars flashing, its siren cranked to peak volume and howling like 1,000 tortured wolves. Seated across a desk from Obeng in the warlord's second-floor office, Le Chat Sauvage heard the ululant wail of the rapidly approaching medical vehicle and tilted his head toward the window. Is that one of yours? Obeng shook his head, no. An ambulance. The wildcat gave him a questioning look. You're certain? Obeng assured him. He was almost shouting to be heard.
Yes. Even here, people get sick.
As he leaped up through the small crater in the garage floor, Ricci didn't know whether it was the detonating C2 or the eardrum-piercing shrillness of the ambulance siren that shocked the attendant from his dozy position on the chair. Not that it made a jot of difference to him. The attendant shot to his feet now, his chair crashing onto its back, his features agape at the sight of men in visored helmets and tactical camo outfits pouring out of a rubble, dust, and smoke-spewing hole that hadn't existed a split second before. Ricci swiftly bound over to him and pressed the squirter of the dimethyl sulfoxide canister clenched in his gloved fist. Ricci caught the attendant in his arms to ease his fall, lowering him gently onto the floor. Then he quickly rose and scanned the garage for ways to reach the buildings above ground levels. His gaze found the door leading to the stairwell to his far left, on the opposite side of the garage. A few steps below the first floor landing, they paused for Rosander to peer around the corner with his telescopic search mirror. Midway to the second floor, on the next landing, Rosander again stuck the pole around the corner and saw the reflections of three men on the mirror's convex surface. He signaled quickly, two fingers pointed at his eyes, enemy in sight. Then three fingers in the air, revealing the number of opponents on the way down. The militiamen were carrying assault rifles, Russian AKs. One of them glimpsed the assault team below. His gun muzzle came up as he warning to his companions. Ricci squeezed the trigger of his baby VVRS, its electronic touch control set for maximum blowback, lethal as lethal could be, and quiet. The militiamen fell to the landing, spots of crimson on his chest. then a quick burst of gunfire from above, bullets swarming down the stairwell. Ricci stayed put and swung his weapon toward the remaining two. The mirror in one hand, Rosander had lifted his gun with the other and was already spraying them with ammunition. A second man collapsed, rolled downward, olive fatigue stained red. The third kept standing, got off some more counterfire, and Ricci heard a grunt from Rosander as the pole of his inspection mirror flew from his fingers and went clattering against the metal risers below. Edging back against the handrail, out of the shooter's direct line of fire, Ricci triggered his gun again, aiming for the legs, and when he saw the legs give out, finished the militiaman with a sustained burst to the chest. Silence. A pale gray haze of smoke. Ricci looked around at Rosander. The visor of his helmet was splashed red, dripping red where he'd been hit. Ricci could not see his face through it. Keeping his eye on the mission, Ricci ordered his unit to resume its hurried advance. As they passed over the bodies lying across the stairs, Grillo snatched the search mirror from where it had dropped. They would need it later on. The strike team pushed through the door to the second-floor hallway, each of its members familiar with the floor plan, knowing the exact location of Obeng's office at the rear of the building. They ran forward, guns at hip level, eyes sweeping the sides of the hall. At the final bend in the corridor, Grillo held out the search mirror's curved pole, glanced into it for barely a second, pulled it back, and turned to the others behind him. He whispered to Ricci,
"Four of Obeng's goons headed straight towards us with AKs, not a dozen feet away in the middle of the corridor. Take them out. I want it done yesterday."
The strike team launched around the corner in a controlled rush, firing short, accurate bursts with their guns. Two of the militiamen dropped before they could return fire, their weapons flying out of their hands like hurled batons. The remaining pair split up, one breaking to the left, the other to the right. Ricci heard the whiffle of subsonic ammo from a baby VVRS, saw the man on the left fall to the floor, arms and legs wishboned. One to go. Ricci hugged the wall, aimed, fired his weapon, unable to get a clean shot at his target. His saddle swung against the doorframe, missing the gunny, but causing him to duck back and momentarily lay off the trigger. Ricci knelt against the wall. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Grillo and the others take advantage of the distraction and dash up the hall toward Obeng's office. He held his weapon absolutely still. Let the gunny lean out of that space 1 inch, just a single goddamn inch. On the opposite side, another green recruit named Nichols held the rammer, while the more experienced hands, Barnes and Newton, stood behind him. Suddenly, movement from where the militiaman was huddled. His back still pressed to the door, he lifted his hands, the tip of his AK tilting outward, his knees unfolding slightly. Ricci inhaled through gritted teeth. As the gunny scuttled into the hall, his weapon spitting bullets, Ricci caught him with a single shot to the center of the chest. He went down hard, his green fatigue shirt turning brilliant red. Ricci pushed from the wall, racing around the fallen bodies in the corridor to join his team. His eyes widened. Nichols had suddenly moved toward the door with the rammer, was swinging it back for momentum, about to drive it against the jamb, unaware of Barnes reaching out to stop him. Ricci shouted, "Hold it!" He could see Nichols try to check himself, but the warning registered an instant too late. His entire upper body was already into the forward swing. The rammer hit the door and it flew inward with a crash, and that was when the attack dogs came lunging out. Pit bulls, five of them, silent and vicious, their voice boxes surgically removed. Their muscles humped and rippling under their pelts, jaws snapping, lips peeled away from their carnivorous white fangs, they sprang into the corridor and were on his men in a heartbeat. A voice from Obeng's office. "Stop. Sit." The pit bulls stopped in their tracks and got onto their haunches, immediately heeding the firm command. "That's it, that's it. Nice doggies." A hand reached from the entrance, rows of shiny gold and silver bracelets clattering around the wrist. Then an arm in a colorful hand-beaded shirt sleeve. The man who stepped into the corridor a moment later had performed his role to the hilt, even dressing the part of a warlord. He bent over the dog nearest the door, scratched behind its ear, then reached into his trouser pocket for some biscuits, and began passing them out to the obedient animals. They crunched them happily, tails wagging, crumbs flying from their jowls. He looked at Ricci.
"Hate to be the one to say this, but..."
The sword op, who'd been the wildcat for the week-long training exercise, strode from the office to finish the sentence for him.
"But your guys just got their balls chewed off."
Expelling a long breath, Ricci turned from the office door in disgust. Down the hall, the militiamen he'd nailed with his practice round rose from the floor and pulled his dye-soaked shirt away from his chest.
"Heh, shit's sticky and cold."
Ricci glared over at Nichols. In that kid's case, getting his balls chewed off was exactly what he could look forward to. No play acting. Various locales, November 6, 2000. Awaken the sleeper. Fee, 50 million. Instructions to follow within 1 week. In his home office in the affluent town of Hanscom, Illinois, the reborn and redubbed Lance Jefferson Freeman, or simply LJ, as his devoted internet radio show listeners affectionately call the founder and crown minister of the Freedom Church, was having thoughts that were in many respects equal to those of Arif al-Ashar in East Sudan. He muttered to himself,
"A kid in a candy store, that's what I am, yes, mister."
Where was he? Oh, yes, the Jews. The Jews. They would be high on his list, probably foremost. It was through books given to him by a cellmate during his prison stint. The most influential had been titled The Wisdom and Prophecies of Adolf Hitler, that L.J. had learned the truth behind the Zionist-occupied government, or ZOG. The Jews, absolutely it had to be them. Pulling together 50 million to rid the land of their domination wouldn't be difficult, considering the resources of his more well-off supporters. A core group of patriots and true believers who'd pledged to open their wallets for cause. In fact, right now he was projecting a surplus of funds, enough to simultaneously purge another corrupting racial element from society. The blacks. Threat number two. Because their goal was to commit genocide upon the children of Adam by intermarrying and procreating with them in violation of divine will. L.J. concluded aloud,
"Meaning they have to go. Go straight away into the bottomless pit. Yes, mister."
And so it went for L.J. Freeman, crown minister of the White Freedom Church, in his Hanscom, Illinois home office, his thoughts rotating around their fixed axis of hatred, like the rings of some dark and hostile planet, twisting on and on and on into the outer extremities of the night. At $50 million, Murdoch Williams considered it a bargain. Wasn't that Williams harbored any personal animosity toward them. His own great-grandparents had been from Russia, fled the pogroms, arrived in America with next to nothing. The Bogners, they'd come over as refugees when the Ruskies pushed into Budapest in 56. So there was a definite feeling of kinship in Williams's heart. But no real estate developer ever reached his level of success by shying away from the bottom line, sympathy and understanding aside. The Mews was what they called those east side apartment houses, erected around wide, gated courts and areaways in the late 1800s. When Williams acquired the properties from their former owner, he'd paid top dollar, but his bean counters estimated his long-range profits to be in the hundreds of millions, possibly over $1 billion, the real value being in the airspace above the existing structures. At stake, therefore, was a staggering bundle, and also the posterity Williams would finally achieve by owning the largest residential structure in New York City, ergo the country, ergo the world. With the T's crossed and the I's dotted on his ownership papers, Williams had lost no time making lavish buyout offers to the residents of the buildings, about 75% of whom had happily taken the deal. It wasn't long before the remaining holdouts cleared the premises, except for the Bogners, who refused to budge from the Mews to which they were sentimentally attached. The Bogners, who, despite their advanced age, appeared to be in sufficiently good health to stay put in their apartment for years to come before finally giving up the ghost. And years was longer than Williams intended to wait. The original notification had been emailed to him, and it struck him as the craziest damn thing. A designer virus, that was what the sender had declared he could provide. Little by little, though, a belief in the claim's legitimacy had begun to emerge in his mind. He replied to the email with a note requesting that he be advised when the product was ready for issue, and then tried his best to focus on other business. Had the Cyber Phantom taken any longer to respond, the impatience would have eaten him up alive. Thank heaven the wait was finally over. He'd have paid 10 times the asking price to end it.
Awaken the sleeper. Fee 50 million. Instructions to follow within 1 week.
San Diego, California, November 8, 2001.
I can't do what you're asking. It isn't an option.
I'm sorry you feel that way, Paladin, because as a matter of fact, it's your only option.
Don't use my name. It isn't safe.
Enrique Quiros shook his head and indicated the portable bug detector on the seat between them.
That's where you're mistaken again, because this is my safe car.
The safe car in which they sat was a Fiat Coupe that Quiros had driven into the parking lot outside the cruise ship terminal on Harbor Drive. It was 6 p.m., the upper rim of the sun sinking into San Diego Bay, the area outside the terminal crosshatched with dusky shadows. Quiros reached into the inner pocket of his sport jacket and produced a zippered leather case.
Everything you need is in here.
I told you I can't do this. It's too dangerous. It's too much for me.
Quiros looked at him in silence for several moments. Then he nodded to himself, turned toward the front of the car, and leaned back against his headrest.
When you wanted money to pay off your gambling debts in Cuyaba, you were glad to sell off confidential information about the layout and security of an installation that it was your job to protect. When you were rotated back to the States and found yourself in hock again, loan sharks riding all over you, you became more than eager to slink into your employer's office and collect material for a genetic blueprint that you knew would be...
Please, I don't feel comfortable talking about...
Quiros raised his hand.
And if that information were to surface, it could put you away in prison for the rest of your life. A decision's been made for you.
Quiros extended the case across the seat without turning from the windshield. In a rental van on the opposite side of the parking aisle, Lathrop began to pack his remote laser voice monitoring system into its black hardshell camera case. From the rear window panel of the van, the invisible beam of the device's near-infrared semiconductor laser diode had been aimed at a 90-degree angle through the back windshield at the Fiat's rearview mirror. Vibrating infinitesimally from the conversation inside the Fiat, the window glass had caused corresponding fluctuations in the optical beam reflecting off it, which were then converted into electronic pulses by the eavesdropping unit's receiver, filtered from background noise, enhanced, and digitally recorded. Lathrop had gotten every word spoken inside the car, and though he wasn't yet certain what they all meant, one thing was eminently clear to him. After days of following Enrique Quiros in a succession of rentals and disguises, days of following his instincts, his patience finally had been rewarded with a deeper and richer load of pay dirt than he could have imagined. San Diego, California, November 14, 2001. Blood for blood. That was how he felt it had to be. Enrique Quiros sat alone in the San Diego office with the words Golden Triangle Services fronting the outer hallway, his designer glasses folded in his shirt pocket, elbows propped on his desk. It had been an hour since he'd returned from the salvage yard and seen the ghastly remains of his nephew, dumped inside that trunk, packed into that trunk with his own blood. And the smell. It seemed to linger in Enrique's nostrils even now, so strong it was almost a taste at the back of his tongue. He'd stood by the car just briefly, a minute or less, but he thought the stench of Felix's decomposing flesh would stay with him for a very long time to come. He pictured Felix in the trunk of that car, his head blown to pieces and gnawed by rats, his flesh cooking in a soup of his own blood. Blood for blood. In his world, that was how it had to be. If Enrique was to be respected, his hands would have to drip red. Taking a deep breath, he turned his eyes from the leather case and reached across his desk for the telephone. Various locales, November 14, 2001. Late Monday afternoon, Roger Gordian lay asleep in his room at San Jose Mercy Hospital, having been given a series of physical examinations, blood tests, and chest x-rays throughout the earlier part of the day. At 4 p.m. on Sunday, he had been transported to the hospital aboard an ambulance, accompanied by his daughter, Julia Gordian Ellis, after losing consciousness in the backyard of her Pescadero residence. Gordian was fully awake and alert upon reaching the ER, where he was joined by his wife, who had been contacted via her mobile phone by Julia while en route to Pescadero from San Jose International Airport. At that time, Gordian's temperature remained elevated, and he was experiencing respiratory difficulties, a painful sore throat, abdominal pains, nausea, muscle aches, and chills. An initial examination by interns on rotation led them to a preliminary diagnosis of influenza and stress due to overexertion. In spite of his repeated insistence that he was fit enough to be discharged and recover at home, the severity of his symptoms led doctors to suggest that he be admitted for routine monitoring and testing, a recommendation to which he eventually acquiesced at the strong urging of his family. Within an hour of his arrival at the ER, Gordian was moved to a private room on the hospital's fifth floor. As was standard procedure for high-profile individuals, hospital security offered him the option of registering under an alias to deflect attention by ambulance and celebrity-chasing reporters. On Ashley's recommendation, the door sign beside room 5C would read, Hardy, Frank. By Monday morning, Gordian's fever had lowered to 101 degrees, and he was feeling stronger, though his breathing continued to be strained and he showed little desire for food. Around 3 in the afternoon, Gordian's attending nurse came to take his temperature, pulse, and blood pressure readings, give him his prescribed Tylenol capsules, and scribble something on his chart. A few minutes afterward, he became groggy and let himself doze off for a while. At 4 p.m., as Gordian slept on the fifth floor, a nurse on station duty two floors below briefly left her desk for the ladies' room. The moment she did, a man in the crisp white uniform of an orderly entered the station from where he had been drifting near a supply closet, treading quietly in crepe-soled shoes. Keeping an eye out for the nurse, he pointed and clicked through several menus on her computer and retrieved the bed assignment information on all patients admitted in the past 24 hours. Seconds later, the data on the patient in room 5C appeared on the computer, minus his falsified name. Returning to the opening screen, the man left the nurse's station and strode along the hall until he found a small, unoccupied patient's lounge and entered it. There, he slipped a wireless phone from his pocket and placed a call on a digitally encoded line. He spoke into the mouthpiece.
He's here.
The bottleneck elevator rose from the upper sublevel and opened to release him with a pneumatic sigh. Emerging into the corridor, he turned to the right and walked past high security doors marked with signs for the laboratories in the connecting hallways behind them. He carried himself lightly for a man of his muscular proportions, and this partially went to explain the dead silence of his progress down the hall. But as the fluorescent panels overhead neutralized shading and shadow with their suffused radiance, so did the thick concrete walls seem to dampen sound, flatten color, deduct from between them all except the essential and functional. While the drab work environment required varying degrees of acclimatization for most of the personnel who spent their days and nights physically isolated, even from the outlying northern wilderness, Siegfried Kuhl found it to his decided liking. Kuhl advanced through the hall, men and women in surgical scrubs moving singly and in groups toward the laboratory entrances on either side of him. This was the only facility of its type on Earth, at the frontier of the development and mass production of biological weapons, of which the sleeper virus was the current acme. Now Kuhl reached a reinforced steel door that divided the corridor beyond from the rest of the building. He put his hand against its intelligent pushplate and paused for his subcutaneous vascular patterns to be IR scanned and matched against a binary file image in an allied database. A millisecond later, a green indicator light flashed on. Then the vault-like door swung inward without a sound as the flow of current to the armature of its electromagnetic lock was briefly interrupted. Kuhl entered a short passage. The walls to his left and right were featureless. The door to the single office at the passage's opposite end, made of dark, heavy wood. Its knob was of gleaming brass. He went to the door and waited. There was no need to announce himself. The biometric scanner that had allowed him into the hallway would have identified him to the office's occupant. and his approach would have been monitored with hidden cameras. A moment later, the door opened. Harlan Devane standing on the other side, his hand on the polished brass handle, wearing a white shirt, white tie, and custom-tailored black suit of perfect outline that might have been stenciled onto his bony frame. He motioned him inside with a flick of his pale, thin hand.
"Siegfried, come in. You'll be pleased to hear the news I've received about Roger Gordian."
Back at Salazar's palatial house by the sea, Lathrop was enjoying himself tremendously. Facing Lucio across the room, watching his expression go in stages from astonishment to acceptance to resentful anger, he couldn't have said whether the greater kick came from a regard for his own expert connivance or the reaction it had instigated.
"This would be funny if it wasn't so incredible. Enrique has Felix steal my shit, kill my people, then they have a falling out over revenue from the hijack. Enrique does Felix, fingers me to his sister as a scapegoat. She tells him I have to die for whacking her son. Next, I get a phone call from Enrique who says he wants to meet, work out our problems. And I agree to it, figuring maybe he's realized he made a mistake and wants to offer reparations. But his real purpose is to do me now."
He thumbed his chest.
"I'm going about my thing, not stepping on anybody's toes, and Enrique's trying to make me a victim twice over."
Lathrop looked at him. The yarn was quite a nifty little twister. "You have to remember where and how this started. The tunnel job was a message. He absolutely means to shove you out of California and knows he has El Tio's fist behind him." Lucio scowled with contempt.
"El Tio, everything's disorder since he's come into the picture. Fucking disorder."
Lucio sat there sucking his front teeth for a while.
"All right, Lathrop, you're the best. And you can count on this tip being worth a nice bonus. As far as how it goes between me and Enrique, we'll see which of us is the fucking idiot 2 nights from now at the park."
Lathrop nodded. It did indeed promise to be an interesting showdown, and he fully looked forward to being ringside.
"It is interesting how we measure our accomplishments. I have many successes behind me and envision more to come. Widespread ventures that yield abundant rewards. Yet the satisfaction I feel at this moment cannot be reckoned. A single person downed, a problem resolved. I hadn't realized Roger Gordian had gotten quite that deeply under my skin."
Kuhl sat across the desk from Devane in silence.
"Gordian remains among the hospital's general population, which means we can infer that he's still in the early stage, but the symptoms will progress quickly enough."
There was a brief pause. Then Devane gestured toward the computer station against the wall to his right, its glowing display filled with rows of unopened email messages.
"Along come the trigger orders, even as we sit here. Multiples in some cases. To no surprise, our Sudanese friend has informed me that he's found a deep well of capital, as have many of his neighbors in the desert. It's enthralling, the eagerness of my clients. Those in the noisy public arenas, those in solitude, those who fear differences of ethnicity and morphology. They want greater prestige, greater wealth, a world refashioned under their influence."
A flit of a smile.
"We're in the money, Siegfried, and I have faith that humanity will keep us in it to stay."
Devane's hands were open on the desk.
"Is there anything else we should discuss?"
Kuhl nodded.
"A recruit in Uplink, the one who administered the trigger to Gordian. He is weak and faithless."
Devane shrugged his shoulders.
"A small fry swimming out of his depth and poisoned along with the big fish. As he must realize by now, I ask myself, what if he tries to bite us in his final thrashings?"
Devane's eyebrows lifted.
"I see. And you suggest that El Tio have Enrique Quiros
put the little creature out of his misery. The sooner the better.
Devane regarded him with his coldly metallic eyes.
Your advice is well taken. I'll contact Enrique.
Various locales, November 15, 2001. When Roger Gordian's personal physician, Dr. Elliot Lieberman, reviewed his case report Tuesday morning, he was left puzzled and dismayed. Gordian was undoubtedly a sick man, but the cause of his illness was a mystery. The flu-like symptoms that hospitalized him Sunday afternoon had shown an appreciable improvement soon after his admission, continued along that positive trend throughout Monday, and then had taken a sharp, unexpected downturn over the past several hours. Sighing with frustration, Lieberman lifted the receiver off his phone to get the chair of the virology department on the line, but then decided that call could wait a bit, and hung up without punching in his extension. There was another person he wanted to speak to first. One of his oldest friends and colleagues, Eric O., was an epidemiologist with the California Health Department, who had performed some of the principal research on molecular methods for the identification of unrecognized and emerging pathogens, and been a celebrated virus hunter for the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. It was a downright breach of protocol to involve Eric before consulting with a senior departmental head in this hospital, but Lieberman was getting gut radar signals. His lips compressed to a barely visible stitch on his long, careworn face. Lieberman retrieved Eric's phone number from his pocket organizer and once again reached for the telephone. Here's what little I know. The boss's condition hasn't improved since this morning, and the tests aren't showing what's wrong with him. His doctor has put in a call to an epidemiologist at the Department of Health in Sacramento. Megan was looking at Pete Nimick and Vince Skull, the three of them seated in Nimick's office at Uplink headquarters. Their meeting hastily convened minutes after Ashley Gordian phoned to update her from the hospital. Nimick's eyes held steady on her face.
That's it?
She nodded. Skull spoke.
Doesn't make sense. A case gets kicked up to state level, means there's either got to be a rash of ones like it or a suspicion that whatever's hit Gord is contagious and a threat to the public welfare.
Megan shook her head. That's what I assume, too. But Ashley explained the contact's strictly unofficial. Lieberman has a personal relationship with the government man, and he's reaching out. Skull frowned, rubbing a hand back and forth over his smooth, hairless expanse of scalp. Then he looked at Megan.
I'm thinking maybe we ought to investigate.
Investigate what?
Same things as the Whitecoats. Say, you're a medical Sherlock. There's a disease you don't recognize. You want to trace its origin. Same as I'd do with some radical political movement in Frick-Frackistan. So you start looking at how the person you're treating might have acquired it. Where has he been lately? Who are his contacts? The next step is to figure out its vectors, how it's spreading. The main thing is that once the information's in your pocket, you're on the way to finding your germ.
He looked from Megan to Pete.
You see where I'm coming from?
The other two were nodding. Megan, with her eyebrows raised. Then from Nimick, where do we start? Skull turned sideways in his chair and rapped his fist on the wall.
Right here, Petey. Uplink HQ. Where the hell else but the boss's home away from home?
San Diego, November 15, 2001. Lathrop exited the CNN website after finding no updated headlines about Roger Gordian's condition, and then restored the profiler application to his computer screen. Blondie's luscious face reappeared in front of him, enlarged and enhanced from the digital video he'd taken near the carousel in Balboa Park. None to his surprise, the program still hadn't made her. The only reason he'd bothered running her image through it again was that he procured a handful of new investigative files from one of his info worms, although for some reason this particular worm wasn't penetrating very deep inside the apple lately, and soon would be worthless as an informant. Leaving his desktop on, he swiveled around in his comfortable leather office chair and reclined to watch his coon cat toy with a favorite ball of yarn.
Okay, Mrs. Frakes, let's see you go for it.
The cat cooed at the sound of his voice. Then she sprang upon the wound-up yarn and twisted onto her back, holding the ball against her middle with her forelegs kicking and raking at it with her sharp rear claws. Lathrop smiled a little. She would work the thing till it became unraveled and spread loosely across the carpet, just as he was working his own ball of yarn. Whatever her identity might be, it was certain Blondie was a courier for El Tío, and her purpose in meeting Enrique Quiros had been to deliver the jewelry box for the obscure narco distributor and instruct Enrique to pass it along to the guy he'd then arranged to meet Harborside. His name was Pallardy, a member of the security or counter-snoop team at Uplink International, whose gambling Jones had gotten him in over his head with some serious operators, and who'd paid off a piece of his debt by turning over classified information about the defense systems of Uplink's manufacturing compound in Brazil. El Tío's involvement in the terrorist raid on that base was unclear to Lathrop, but it probably didn't have much importance at this stage, and he hadn't concerned himself with it. Pallardy had been given some kind of biological agent, something new under the sun, and been ordered to take out Roger Gordian with it. Lathrop glanced around at the pretty lady on his computer screen and remembered the afternoon he'd followed Enrique to his rendezvous with her. Remembered watching the carousel make its slow rotations with the Blue Danube piping in the background, the rowdy, stoned-out teenagers on the lead horses rising from their saddles, stretching their arms to reach for the silver and brass rings above them, only the gleaming brass worth a prize. A smile ghosted at the corners of Lathrop's mouth again. The brass ring. California, November 16, 2001. The condominium subleased by Donald Pallardy belonged to a large block of units Uplink International had acquired to house its mid-level employees in one of the newer planned developments in Sunnydale, a suburban community with the conceit of a major city, about 15 miles south of San Jose. As he rolled his Jetta into the driveway, Ricci's first observation was that Pallardy's van was in his carport. His second was that Pallardy hadn't brought in his newspapers for a few days. There were three lying on his walk in their plastic delivery bags. He strode to the door, rang the bell, and waited. No one answered. He fingered the buzzer again, keeping it depressed a little longer. Still nobody. Then he knocked without getting a response. After a few minutes, he leaned over to peek through the glass panels on either side of the door, but they were covered with louvered screens. The shade was likewise fully drawn over the front window. Ricci tried the doorknob. Locked. He bent to examine it out of old habit. A typical key-in cylinder lock. He could retract the bolt with a credit card in 10 seconds flat. In fact, the door had been opened that way before, judging by the scratches on the rim and doorframe. That prompted another observation. The scratches looked as if they might be fresh. He thought about using the card trick to admit himself right now, but then dismissed the notion. He stood there at the door, attempting to remember the street where he passed the management office. A quarter hour and multiple wrong turns later, he found it on Lupine. The building manager was a man named Perez, whose reservations about admitting a stranger to Pallardy's apartment unit began to dissipate the instant Ricci flashed his Uplink security ID card. "We're pretty concerned. Nobody's heard from him in days." Perez seemed fascinated with the sword insignia.
"I do this. Got to stick around while you're inside."
In the walkway, Perez fumbled with his keys for a second, found the right one, and pushed open the door. They found the living room unoccupied, utterly still, except for the ticking of the cuckoo clock. Ricci stood in the entry.
"Pallardy, you here?"
Silence. Stillness. Ricci stepped past the building manager to another door, slightly ajar. He grabbed the doorknob and entered. In the doorway behind him, Perez inhaled sharply at the sight of the body. Pallardy was lying in bed on his back, his eyes wide open. A blanket covered him to the chest. His face was gray, with dark purple blemishes on the cheeks and forehead. His mouth was twisted into what appeared to be a grimace of pain. The hand sticking out from under the blanket was hooked into a claw, the visible portion of his bare arm also lesioned.
"You should stay back."
Perez didn't need encouragement.
"Si, I got to call the cops."
Ricci produced a business card and pen from inside his sport jacket, wrote hastily on the back of the card, and handed it to him.
Do me a favor. Contact the guy whose name and number I jotted down. That's Pete Nimick at Uplink. Let him know what we found here. If you don't mind, I think it might be better if he's the one who gets in touch with the police.
Perez nodded and took the portable phone out of his pocket. Ricci turned back into the room, reached into his own pocket for the scrub mask and latex gloves he'd brought with him, and put them on. Then he went over to the bed for a closer look at the dead man. The skin at the back of his neck pebbled. Pallady's stomach had tossed up whatever was inside it. His gaping, cyanotic lips were crusted with vomit. His face, too. It had overflowed onto his pillows, sheet and blanket, leaving them splashed with yellowish stains. Ricci looked around the room. On the right wall was what looked like a vintage baseball dugout clock, the Brooklyn Dodgers logo on it. Quite a collector's item. The rest of the sparse furnishings were contrastingly unremarkable. Next to the desk, a computer printer on a wheel stand. Ricci stepped over to the desk and rolled back the chair, then crouched to look into the knee hole. The two bidirectional data cables on the floor weren't attached to anything at his end. One had a parallel port connector, the other a phone-style plug-in jack. Ricci's eyes traced the first cable to the back of the printer. The other cable went to a LAN modem on the carpet about 4 feet away. The network modem's power light was glowing green to indicate it was turned on. Ricci rose and turned toward the entrance. Perez was already putting away his phone.
I talked to your friend. Says he's going to call police right away. Says you should stay and meet them.
Ricci nodded.
Do you know if Pallady owned a computer? Ever notice a machine on his desk when you were doing repairs or anything like that?
Perez shrugged.
Can't remember. I come inside here maybe 2-3 times before today, that's it. Why you ask?
Ricci grunted and shook his head.
Just curious.
Various locales, November 16, 2001. Phil Hernandez, the chief countersnoop, was snagged to lead Nimick and Ricci into Pallady's office minutes after Ricci returned from Sunnydale. Ashley Gordian had called with word of her husband's rapid downturn and isolation, and the two sword ops couldn't afford to lose any time.
You know anybody who fraternized with Pallady?
Hernandez shook his head.
Don kept to himself, didn't even mention he used to be married till I noticed that snapshot over there and asked him about it.
He tipped his head toward a small picture frame on Pallady's desk. The photo showed a plump woman with a nice face and lively smile, crouched on a beach blanket with two small children, a boy and girl.
Don told me he was divorced a few years ago. Wife took custody of the kids. I think she lives somewhere back east.
Another shake of his head, this time accompanied by a sigh.
Jesus, I suppose I'd better see if I can get her address from personnel. Somebody's got to notify his family.
Ricci glanced around the room. It was a tiny, windowless cubicle, as unremarkable as Pallady's condominium had been. A computer workstation stood against one wall. Ricci recalled the two disconnected cables under Pallady's bedroom desk. He turned to Hernandez.
I need to sit down at his computer and check out what's on Pallady's hard drive.
It's all yours.
The first application Ricci accessed on Pallady's computer was his email reader, thinking it would be the logical place to search for contacts. Before checking his address book, Ricci scanned the unopened messages on his queue. One description caught Ricci's interest. It said, from subject received at dpallady, uplink.com, none, 11/14/2000, 4:36 a.m. Ricci turned to Nimick in the chair beside him, pointing toward the mailer's address.
Look at that. Pallady sent it to himself.
Nimick looked.
Early Tuesday morning. Very early.
And almost a full day after anybody at Uplink last heard from him, both men thought. Nimick leaned forward.
Well, open it already. What are we waiting for?
Ricci highlighted the description on the screen, double-clicked his mouse, and read the contents of the email. He looked at Nimick again.
What the hell's this?
Hello? Eric O, please.
Speaking. Eric, it's Steve Koronis over at Sobel Genetics. I know you asked me to call on your direct office line, but I must have misplaced the number. Had to go through the switchboard. No problem. What have you got on Gordian's virus specimens? Everything is strictly unofficial, okay? Even without whole staff on this, we need 24 hours minimum to make a reliable determination, and it hasn't even been... It's unofficial. Hold on to your seat. The PCR screening shows your isolate doesn't match any known strain of hantavirus, which, from what you've told me, shouldn't come as a surprise. But there appear to be RNA sequences that don't occur naturally in the species or in the family. They're at the regulation sites on the genome, right where you'd expect to find them if, well, components had been inserted.
Are you telling me the virus was artificially modified?
I'm telling you there are signs of genetic modification, yes. The phone cradled between his neck and shoulder. Eric looked down at his hand. He was indeed holding on to his seat, literally holding on, his knuckles white as bleached bone. Various locales. November 16, 2001. Something like this. One look at it tells you almost as much as it doesn't. James Carmichael was seated behind Pallardy's computer, studying the enigmatic series of letters and punctuation marks in his email. Nimick and Ricci exchanged glances from where they stood, bookending him. A 30-ish man in shirt sleeves with sharp blue eyes and a bumper crop of wavy black hair, Carmichael looked over his shoulder at Nimick. First, I think we could rule out that it's the product of an incoherent mind. It's too systematic in its construction. I also think what we've got in front of us isn't, strictly speaking, a code, but a cipher. Ciphers create substitutions for independent letters or syllables, and they allow for more complex communications. He indicated several spots on the lines of characters. Frequent recurrences of letter groups are a fair giveaway that they're replacing small linguistic units. See the letter pair BH? It appears 10-11 times. Silence hung a minute. Then, from Nimick, "It's crazy. Pallardy composes a secret message before he dies, emails it here. He must want us to be able to get at it. I can't see why else he goes to the trouble." Carmichael nodded. "Agreed. You think you could find the key, whatever Pallardy's intentions might have been? I know we can do a successful cryptanalysis, break the system without a key. But truthfully, I can't estimate how long it would take. Could be hours, days, even weeks." Ricci frowned. "If Pallardy wasn't playing games with us, wanted to tell us something, what the hell was he thinking? Why bother encrypting his message?" Carmichael looked from one man to the other. "Maybe Pallardy wanted the person who got hold of the computer to know he'd sent us a message, but have to sweat about what information it contained. Maybe he wasn't playing with our heads, but his." Carmichael sat at his desk with the door locked behind him, his telephone unplugged and his intercom and corporate cellular turned off. He needed to be alone, to think. There was something about the bigrams and polygrams, something that kept tickling Carmichael's mind right below the uppermost level of consciousness. And he had a feeling Pallardy had wanted it that way. Carmichael stared at his monitor. He muttered into the silent room, "Something." A thoughtful expression on his face, hands poised over his keyboard, Carmichael decided to remove the punctuation marks from the character string. He typed, repeatedly tapping the delete key. Carmichael stared at the monitor, trying to stay mentally loose and limber, slip into what athletes like to call the zone, a space where you didn't second-guess yourself, where you let yourself be guided by the automatic cognitive and sensory processes that equaled instinct. "Come on, give it up." He typed again, splitting up the obvious letter groups. Carmichael stared at the monitor. And here it came again, that tickle of a thought in his brain soil. Some of those discrete letter pairs. What was it about them that seemed to bait it out? Carmichael did a quick cut and paste to put the combinations that kept drawing his eye onto a separate screen. GW, JA, TJ, JM, AJ. He stared at them. Then he abruptly reached into his pocket, activated his cellular. It's quirky, but clever. Carmichael was explaining virtually as Nimick and Ricci reached his door. Sort of a cross between a polyalphabetic and geometric cipher. The GW in particular. How many people don't immediately think George Washington when they look at that letter pair? Once I let my nose follow that clue, I started noticing other bigrams also corresponded to presidential initials. Jefferson, Jackson. Each of his character groups were substitutions representing the initials of United States presidents. I chose the first 26 sets of initials, one for each letter of the alphabet. Carmichael went over to his computer console and tapped at the keyboard. The lines you'll see on top of the screen show the plain text as it appears when first deciphered. In the bottom of the panel, I've capitalized letters and inserted spaces and punctuation to make it legible to you. Nimick and Ricci looked. The panel below read, Enrique Quiros gave me the disease. I gave him Roger Gordian. There are men beyond either of us who ordered it. I never meant for this to happen. Forgive me. Nimick and Ricci stared at each other. California, November 2001. It was 10 p.m. when Enrique Quiros drove his moon-gray Fiat coupe from the grounds of his Rancho Santa Fe mansion through an electric gate in its 8-foot-high wrought-iron perimeter fence, accompanied by two Lincoln Town cars that flanked him front and rear. Their route to the southbound entry ramp went along a loose braid of quiet palm-lined streets and county roads, and then skirted the cluster of specialty shops and gourmet restaurants in and around the small downtown. As they passed one of the busier eateries, a dark green Saab 9-5 wagon drew away from the curb a few yards farther up the street, easing in front of Quiros's lead car. At the same instant, a young man and woman chatting beside a Cherokee parked near the restaurant's outdoor cafe suspended their conversation and climbed into the SUV, looking to all eyes like an attractive couple who had gone to dine out on this pleasantly cool November night. Just before they reached the first of several signs guiding traffic to the freeway entrance, a Toyota Prius gasoline electric emerged into the intersection from a cross street and then swung between the Cherokee and the Lincoln immediately behind Quiros. The Cherokee's driver glanced at the woman to his right.
What's up with the electric razor?
Could be its pilot wants to prove you can be fuel-efficient and an asshole.
Or could be that he's trying to queer our tail.
The woman frowned. A moment after the Prius cut in behind the Lincoln, its driver tilted his head unnoticeably upward to speak into the hands-free trunked band radio mounted on its roof.
Very good. We are in position.
On a sleepy residential block southwest of Balboa Park, a customized town and country minivan sat in a parking space where it apparently had been left for the night. In the minivan's rear, the little man seated at his control station acknowledged the message from the Prius's driver, told him he would await his further report, and then switched frequencies on his transmitter to notify his marksmen in the park of their target's progress.
What the hell kind of car is this anyway?
An 88 Buick LeSabre T-Type. Why?
Derek Glenn was with a contingent of SWORD personnel assigned to a locally based uplink division specializing in the development of secure corporate and government intranet sites. Ricci looked at him from the passenger seat.
Can't belong to the company pool.
Is that some kind of put-down?
Because you might want to remember that she's gotten you everywhere you've been going all day.
In other words, it's your personal vehicle.
My personal sweetheart. And she's never let me down.
They rode briefly in silence, moving west on El Cajon Boulevard toward Balboa. Ricci looked at the dash clock. It was almost a quarter past 10.
How much longer till we're at the park?
Maybe 10 minutes or so. I know a few places nearby where we can haul in the car and wait.
Ricci looked thoughtful.
Let's squawk our moving surveillance cars again. See about that Prius.
Sitting in his parked Cadillac sedan along with four hand-picked bodyguards, Lucio Salazar shrugged his jacket sleeve back from his wristwatch and read the time. As Enrique Quiros approached Balboa from the northwest, the third automobile in his entourage separated from the others and took the turnoff to the Cabrillo Bridge. Inside the tail vehicles that had kept pace with Quiros since he'd left the ranch, the members of each surveillance team noted this unexpected development and promptly advised their respective superiors. Ricci turned to Glenn.
What do you make of it?
Glenn had pulled the LeSabre into a dark, empty employee lot behind a municipal building on C Street, within view of the park.
The bridge hooks up with Laurel Street, and that'll take you over to Balboa.
He turned to Ricci.
What's that email we got again?
Ricci frowned, took his cell phone out of his pocket, retrieved the stored message Nimick had forwarded from San Jose.
Read the damn thing yourself.
Glenn did. Quiros, 11 p.m., Balboa Park. Final closeout. Everything up for grabs. Get what you want before he's gone, from one who knows. Ricci looked at Glenn.
Do we have people sitting on the area?
Some, and we could shuffle more over. Ricci nodded.
Lucio. Enrique.
They shook hands. It was a few minutes shy of 11 o'clock, and they were standing in the darkened parking lot behind the Spanish village. Salazar's caddy on one side of them, Quiros's Fiat coupe and Lincoln on the opposite side. Their bodyguards grouped loosely near the cars from which they'd emerged. Quiros looked at Salazar in silence a moment, the cool night breeze riffling his lightweight sport jacket around his body.
Now we talk. See if we can find a way to straighten out our problems.
Salazar tilted his head toward their guards.
We need to give ourselves some room. Take a walk. Air things in privacy.
Quiros nodded.
I propose we each bring one man to follow behind as a precaution. Leave the rest here with the cars.
Salazar had to grin.
Got to make sure we don't kill each other on the garden path.
Enrique looked at him.
I'm glad you're smiling, Lucio.
The four Quiros soldiers that had been hastily assigned to follow had exited the breakaway Lincoln at the far western end of El Prado, advanced across the gardens and meadows to the thoroughfares north, and then finally taken positions of hiding on either side of a thickly hedged walkway. In the town and country, the small man at the monitoring station saw Quiros's men slip into the hedges through his optical relay with the shooter on the museum's rooftop, who had noticed their movement while surveying the area through his long-range scope. A stroke of good fortune for Lucio Salazar. Little was said between Quiros and Salazar as they left the parking area, walking south past the Spanish village toward the green dominated by the Moreton Bay fig tree, their bodyguards following like unspeaking golems, near enough for their presence to be felt, far enough away for it to be unobtrusive. At the eastern border of the green, Quiros paused a beat, glanced around as if to gain his bearings, then started briskly onto a path that would take them past the side of the Natural History Museum and into the Plaza de Balboa at the east end of El Prado. Salazar touched his shoulder, noting his quickened pace.
Lawn shorter. If it's okay with you, I'd like to cut across it instead.
Quiros appraised him quietly. He'd heard the mistrust in his tone, seen his reluctance to take the path.
Why not? I picked the spot, you picked the route.
Salazar gave him a thin smile. That was exactly where Quiros had meant to steer him all along, knowing his men were in position at its western side, hidden there in the shrubs that bordered on the walkway, leading toward the reflecting pond, lying in wait, ready to spring their ambush. As soon as they got halfway across the green, Salazar slowed to halt and stood gazing at the Moreton Bay fig.
We should talk about Felix.
Quiros looked at him. This was not how it was supposed to happen. He wanted to get to the damned garden walkway.
Let's hold off. The pond is a better place. We can sit there and...
Salazar raised a hand abortively and faced him.
Now, Enrique.
Quiros studied his expression. It left no room for argument.
You had a problem with my nephew. You should have come to me. For what? The problem?
Like you said, it was never him. He wouldn't have done that job at the tunnel if you didn't authorize it.
Kiros shook his head. He was on his own. Salazar's voice was at once weary and bitter.
We came all the way here. Might as well be straight.
Kiros inhaled, exhaled. That's what's been wrong from the start, Lucio. You answering your own questions. Making up your mind before you know the facts. You took things into your own hands. What you did. How could you think it would resolve anything?
What I did?
Killing my nephew, my sister's only son. What were you thinking? Salazar glared with anger.
Even here, between us, you're trying to pass off that bullshit.
He never got to finish his sentence. There were four simultaneous flashes from four different points above the green. Four rifle cracks that merged into one loud, echoing sound that split the night like a thunderclap. Salazar jerked with surprise and confusion as Kiros's head snapped sideways, blood misting up around it and spurting from a hole in his chest, and then his mouth dropped open, and blood was pouring from it, too, streaming over his lips and chin. Kiros went down, folded almost neatly, and lay still there in front of him on the grass. His eyes widened with confusion. He hadn't given the order. What the hell had happened here? Ricci and Glenn were within 15 yards of the hedges when they heard the discharge of the sniper gun smack the air up ahead.
Where you think the shooting came from?
Glenn started to answer, then abruptly tapped his radio earpiece to indicate he'd been squawked, and listened. His features were stunned as he ten-fored into the unit's neck mic.
Kiros is down. The green, back of the museum.
One brief glance at the body on the grass was all it took to establish there wasn't a spark of life remaining in it. Far across the lawn, Ricci could see Glenn looking up at the tops of the buildings around them, standing with his gun loosely at rest against his leg. The roofs looked empty. The monster tree looked empty. Not much risk to being here. The snipers were probably gone by now. Glenn raised a hand to catch Ricci's eye and signaled that he wanted to do a walk around, pointing toward the front of the museum. Ricci waved for him to go ahead and watched him turn the building's corner, leaving him alone with the body. Ricci knelt over it, looked down at it, the night feeling very deep around him, its chill penetrating his clothes. He never heard anyone slipping up on him, never heard a sound. Despite his natural alertness, his finely keyed senses, not a sound until the voice spoke out of the darkness mere inches behind his back. Shazam, it said.
Jesus Christ! What'd you guys think they were doing?
Lucio Salazar barked into his cellular. Shaken and baffled, still clueless about why his hired triggers had opened fire, he was speeding from the park in his caddy. Unaware he'd just passed the spot where Sword's roadblock for Enrique Quiros had been lifted moments earlier.
It would be better if you could give me some respect. Quiros had people in the bushes ahead of you. I saw at least one of them holding a gun.
Salazar's brow wrinkled.
Are you sure? I know my job. Should I have waited until you reached those men?
Not quite knowing how to respond, Salazar got off the phone and sat quietly as his driver turned toward the highway. Kiros had seemed to genuinely believe it was the Salazar family that offed his bastardo nephew. On the other hand, Kiros had set a trap for him along the path. The lines on Salazar's forehead grew deeper. The best thing for him was probably to be thankful he was still in one piece and move on. But questions of what Kiros had or hadn't known or done kept gnawing at him. Because if there was even a speck of truth in the words he'd spoken before he was killed, it would cast serious doubt upon the reliability of Lathrop's information. And then you'd have to start asking how Lathrop could have gotten it so wrong, and wondering about his motivations, his intentions. The Cadillac was swinging onto the entrance ramp to I-5, heading north to Del Mar, where the timed explosive charge beneath its fuel tank suddenly detonated with a crumping blast, sending a burst of flame through its interior, its force punching out metal, blowing out both windshields and three of its four side windows, leaving Salazar's questions to vaporize in the smoke and superheated air. Ricci's hand went to his 5.7, drew the pistol from its holster even as he turned fast at the hip and looked behind him. The man standing there was dressed entirely in black, regarding him with sharp, intelligent eyes. His hands were straight down at his sides. One was empty. The other held a square, flat object that Ricci would have immediately recognized as a CD gem case had the setting been different. In the context of his present situation, it took him a second or two. He studied the man's face. If the gun Ricci was pointing at him gave him any fear, he showed no sign of it.
"Who are you?"
The man tilted his head up a little, his lips parting, seeming for the briefest of moments to gaze past Ricci into the night sky. Then he locked eyes with him. "One who knows, but I'll bet you already have that figured out." Ricci's gun was steady in his grip, but it felt suddenly cold.
"Tell me, what the hell you want?"
The man shook his head. "It's what you want that's important, and I've got it right here in my hand." He lifted the gem case from his side, held it out toward Ricci.
"Take it. Poor Enrique here's a dead end, so you might as well. What's there to lose? Maybe you'll feel you owe me one, but that will be up to you."
Ricci did not move for a long moment. Then he slowly reached out to the man and took the case from him, keeping his gun trained on his chest. The man's hand dropped back to his side.
"I'm going to steal away into the night now. Just tell me I don't have to worry about you putting a slug into me for some odd reason."
Ricci was still watching his eyes.
"You already have that figured."
The man smiled and dipped his head in a gesture that almost resembled a bow. Then the man turned and walked into the darkness, heading toward a nearby footpath, disappearing into the shadows beneath the trees rising tall on either side of it, leaving Ricci crouched over the body of Enrique Quiros, alone in the silent green, one hand around his gun, the other holding tightly onto a mystery. Northern Ontario, Canada, November 17, 2001. Remote was a relative term nowadays. Paul Pokey Oscabus was saying this as he dipped his single-prop Cessna 172 from the cloud rack. He banked sharply toward the bunched, snow-draped hills to port. Seated on his right, Ricci watched the world slant down and away.
"How long till we're over the plant?"
"Should be any minute." Cree Ojibwe Indian, with a wide, bony face and dark hair worn in a buzz cut, Oscabus was on loan to Ricci from the Sword Watch located midway between the Big Nickel Mine in Sudbury and Lake Superior.
"You see the twin rises over there, sort of rounded. Got all those wrinkles in them. The local tribes call them Nish Obekwan, means two shoulders. And then that third, taller slope, far side of it on the west face, is our spot. Go ahead and check the moving map on the instrument panel. It'll help with your orientation. Soon as we cross that next hill, you'll catch sight of Earthglow to your right, down on a ledge near its base."
Ricci kept silent, his pale blue eyes staring out the window. In a large conference room on the Sudbury ground station, Raleigh Thibodeau and the rest of the 24-man rapid deployment team were gathered before a flat-panel wall monitor, viewing the same pictures that appeared on the Cessna's video display as it made its flyby. The Earthglow facility was a low concrete building, backed directly against the almost vertical eastern slope, bounded on its other three sides by a high industrial chain-link perimeter fence, topped with multiple rows of electrical wiring. A sliding gate in the north-facing section of the fence opened onto a two-lane blacktop that curved along the base of the hill and then stretched off eastward toward the railway station at Hawk Junction, about 100 miles distant, across rolling, heavily forested country. Watching the stream of recon images over his microwave link with the aircraft, Bedeau muttered unhappily under his breath. He knew Tom Ricci better than he liked, and could anticipate the mission plan he would present upon returning to base. What bothered him, in part, was that it stood to be dangerous to the extreme. The thing that filled him with deepest distress was also knowing there was no workable alternative. That night before his group set out on their cross-country hike, Ricci emerged out of the metallized fabric igloo tent,
and stood surrounded by the humped granite rises of Nish Obequan, their furrowed contours otherworldly in the darkness. Ricci stood there, alone, outfitted in a snow camo-shell jacket and pants, a polar liner, his Xylon vest, and thermal undergarments. His hands were covered with ultra-thinsulate gloves that wouldn't get in the way of firing his weapon. His sleekly molded full-head helmet was equipped with an integrated hands-free wireless audio-video system, its dime-sized color digital camera lens invisible above his forehead, its microphone embedded in the chin guard. Never in the coldest, bleakest Maine winter had he experienced such inimical cold. No sane human being would expose himself to it without good reason. He turned around now, stepped back toward the tent, and then leaned his head through its entrance flap to signal his men to gear up and assemble. He'd had his moment of solitude and was ready to get underway. Ricci's recollections of the climb would later streak together in his mind, staying with him as a mostly random shuffle of images and impressions. He would remember seeking out Pokey Oscaboose's ascending shadow, following his lead, trying not to fall too far behind, and then finally the crest of the hill was above him. And almost to his own surprise, he was standing beside Oscaboose, the rest of his party appearing in ones and twos and threes, helping each other gain the final bit of ground, gathering there atop the rise overlooking the blockish spread of the Earthglow facility. They descended the hill as they had started up its opposite side, in single file. When his boots touched ground, a glance at the tritium dial of his wristwatch showed that over 2 hours had passed since his group had left camp. Longer than he'd expected, maybe. But thanks to Pokey Oscaboose, they had gotten this far without a single injury worse than a bump or bruise. And straight ahead of them now was Earthglow, its shadow deeper than the black of night. Pressed against Earthglow's windowless back wall, Ricci watched Rosander Nose's telescoping probe around its corner with a powerful sense of déjà vu. Still, he was acutely aware that Cape Green had been little more than a stage set. Africa one day, Balkan Europe the next. The image from Rosander's probe was superimposed on Ricci's visor display and showed a pair of guards in hooded parkas, goggles, and wool scarves taking relaxed strides along their patrol of the building's north side. Their shoulder-slung FN-P90 assault weapons fired the same ammunition as his 5.7 pistol. Small rounds, big punch. After what seemed an age, they approached the corner of the wall. Ricci's arm came up like a semaphore. Sebold moved with him at once. They rounded the corner and got right in the guards' faces with their canisters. Silently and painlessly KO'd, the guards hit the ground unconscious, and then were flex-cuffed and dragged into the shadows at the base of the hill. They would be out for hours. Hugging the north wall of Earthglow about 100 feet from the gatehouse, his men drawn up behind him, Ricci could see three guards through the plate-glass windows of the booth. Two were seated behind a control panel with a bank of video monitors on it, talking, neither of them apparently paying attention to the screens. A third was dozing on a chair behind a desk. Ricci called four men over to him. His instructions took seconds. Fast, quiet.
"You still with us, Thibodeau?" Ricci asked over the comlink.
"Check." Thibodeau replied from the Two Shoulders camp. Ricci paused a moment to order his thoughts, then spoke.
"Doc?"
"I'm here." This was the voice of Eric O. at the San Jose headquarters with Nimick and Megan. "They just patched me into the AV a minute or two ago. Where are you in the building right now? It looks like a kitchen." And a kitchen it was, a big one, too. Obviously, it produced food for the resident staff. Ricci looked around, his helmet's monocular NVD sight down over his right eye. Minus Oscaboose, his team had made their way through the open freight entrance and then down a couple of dim and empty branching corridors, seeking the path of least resistance into the main section of the building.
"Yeah, Doc. Hang tight. We're moving."
Ricci started toward a tall swing door at the far end of the room, pushed through the door, his men at his heels. He rapidly led his team along the darkened corridor and turned in the direction of the arrow marker,
aware of the dull, leached-away sound of their footsteps between the thick concrete walls. At the juncture with the connecting hall was another set of swing doors. He gently shouldered through the partition into the milky wash of light. The doors lining the sides of this passage were no longer of the ordinary office building variety. These were metal-clad, bullet-resistant installations, most with swipe readers and entry code keypads.
You have any pointers, Doc? Let's hear them.
My guess is you're heading in the right direction. Wait. Slow down. I want to look at that sign to your right. Ricci turned so his helmet camera was facing it. The sign read, Flow Cytrometry.
Okay. Thanks. That's not what we need.
Ricci hastened down the passage.
What am I keeping my eyes out for?
Signs with terms like coacervation or fluid bed coating or hot melt systems. The microencapsulation units themselves consist of several large batch tanks or chambers. Oh, suddenly broke off his sentence. From his monitor, thousands of what Ricci had just spotted ahead of him at an intersection in the hall. It had pushed his heart up into his throat. Ricci knew at a glance that the guards who'd appeared in the passage had better stuff than the perimeter security crew. Swiftly raising his weapon, its MEMS touch control and its lethal setting, Ricci had the briefest instant to once again recall the Cape Green maneuvers with that strange sensation of events doubling back in themselves. The thought had not quite fled his mind as he opened fire, ordering his men to spread out and do the same. The guard he targeted was only a little slower to trigger his own gun. He collapsed to the floor, his uniform blouse chewed and bloody, his rifle dropping from his hand. Ricci saw a second guard train his sub-gun on one of the men behind him, instantly swung his around and triggered another burst, a five-shot salvo. But this time the guard managed to squeeze out a volley before falling onto his back, and he kept shooting even afterward, scattering a gale of ammunition across the hall. Ricci heard a grunt of pain from over his shoulder, didn't turn. He angled the VVRS down and fired again, and so did another member of the insertion team. Red exploded from the guard's belly. He rolled over and there was red splashed in his back from the exit wounds, and then he flopped a little and lay still. More gunfire from Ricci's left, more from his rear, and he turned to see the third guard shiver in place a moment and then spill loosely off his feet. He spun around to see who'd been hit. Grillo. On his back, blood streaming from his throat. Simmons and Beatty were kneeling over him, getting off the helmet, opening the collar of his jacket. But he wasn't moving, and his open eyes had the look Ricci knew came with the touch of death.
Doc, I've got to hear from you.
Ricci snapped over the comlink. His team was speeding along the corridor, away from the section where the firefight had broken out.
Tom, listen, it's me. Pete, where the hell is he? We're running blind here.
I know. Eric saw the whole thing. What happened to Grillo? He's pretty shaken up.
Then pull him together.
Tom, for God's sake, we know your situation.
It was Megan, her voice tense.
Give him half a second.
Eric's voice broke in. I'm all right. Sorry. I just...
Later. We're coming up to another cross hall. A bunch of signs. Can you read them?
No. You're moving too fast. The picture's blurry.
I'm going to stop and let you take a look. But we don't have long. I don't know who might have heard those guns.
Ricci signaled a halt, then craned his head toward the signs, turning it to allow the helmet's digicam to pan across his visual path.
You see them okay?
Yes.
Wait. The sign on your left.
No, the next one over.
Ricci's eyes held on the sign. It said... Aqueous phase separation.
That's it.
Ricci swung his gaze to the left. A steel door barred the way about 3 feet down the corridor junction. He turned to his men.
They know we're here. No point tiptoeing. We blow our way in. You six stay here and cover the entry.
Ricci motioned to his team.
Watch yourselves. That boom must have set off alarms everywhere. We don't know what kind of manpower's headed this way.
In Earthglow's main security station,
Siegfried Kuhl studied the flashing light on his electronic display's building schematic. The blast's location supported what he had already construed about the goal of the intruders. And the connection between their goal and identity was like a match brightly struck in his mind. Wait, that one. No, no, you're pulling the wrong disc. Count two up. Okay, that's it.
Ricci slid the gem case from the cabinet and turned it over in his hand, so the print on its index label faced his helmet's digital camera lens. Silence over the comlink.
Doc, I need you to slip it into your wearable. Send me its contents so I can have a look.
Ricci bit his lip. He could hear gunfire somewhere in the direction of the blown security door. Reaching down to the miniature computer on his belt, he ejected its CD-ROM tray, set in the disk, and pushed the tray shut. Then he hit the preset uplink intranet key and uploaded the disk's contents as a wireless email attachment. Tortured seconds passed.
Well? The data's coming through now. I'm going to scan it online. Give me a chance to...
Ricci's heart knocked.
Well? My God. Oh, my God, Ricci. This is unbelievable.
His Sig Sauer P220 in his hand, should the enemy be waiting near its door, Kuhl rode the pneumatic elevator up from the biofarm sublevel. The underground passages he'd taken had enabled him to bypass the breached security entrance on Earthglow's main floor. The elevator stopped. Outside in the corridor, Simmons and Rosander heard the whisper of the arriving car and raised their VVRS weapons. Kuhl caught a glimpse of them before its door fully opened. His edge over them in speed might have been narrow. In his merciless capacity to kill without restraint, he was a creature alone. Simmons was on the left of the elevator, and as he prepared to give its passenger a warning, Kuhl pivoted toward him, stepped in close under his gun arm, and brought his own pistol up to Simmons' side, pushing the muzzle between his fourth rib and underarm, where he knew the straps of his soft ballistic vest would leave an unprotected gap. Three shots of Teflon-coated 45 ACP rounds against his body. Three muffled blats of sound as the snout of the gun discharged through layers of cold-weather clothing, and Simmons went down to the floor. Rosander had been unable to do anything but hold his fire, fearing he might accidentally hit his teammate. But as Simmons crumbled, he brought his weapon to bear. He was almost fast enough. In a streak, Kuhl spun toward Rosander on the ball of his foot, moved in at him, grabbed his wrist behind the outthrust VVRS, and twisted it sharply around, wrenching it, simultaneously slamming his powerful forearm up under Rosander's chin to crush his windpipe. Hearing gunshots down the corridor to his right, knowing Ricci desperately needed more time in the room behind him, Nichols turned and rushed toward the sound of the reports. All at a glance, he saw a man he recognized as the Wildcat standing above Simmons' blood-soaked form, saw Rosander slumped near the wall behind them, and with a surge of horror, opened fire on the killer. Cold-eyed, Kuhl triggered the VVRS he had taken from Rosander, aiming low, a right-to-left sweep of the barrel. Kuhl fired three accurate bursts into him, saw the body quiver as 15 bullets ripped into it, and for an instant considered advancing farther up the hall. His teeth clicked. Footsteps were coming from the penetration site behind him, four sets, the sound of their heavy boots distinct from those of his own men. Kuhl took an instant to consider, and then made his decision. He turned toward the elevator, pressed the call button, stepped through the opening, and retreated.
Oh, my God, Ricci! This is unbelievable!
Ricci's face was bathed in sweat.
Talk fast, Doc. Have we got what we need?
We have it, yes. We have it, we have it. Several different types of inhibitors, stored as computer models rather than pills. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of activators. The virus must be infinitely mutable.
Ricci's attention broke away from whatever O was telling him. He turned abruptly, ran across the room, through the door, and into the corridor. Looked left, then right.
No sign of Nichols in either direction. His heart malloting in his chest again, he bounded down the hall, swung a corner past the microencapsulation lab, putting on speed. This was where the shots had come from. Another turn, and then Ricci was met by the scene near the bottleneck elevator. It was a sight he would remember always. Nichols was on the floor between him and the elevator door, sprawled on his back. Simmons and Rosander were down at the elevator itself. Ricci dashed forward and knelt beside Sebold. Then, weakly, Nichols' hand came up from his side, and Ricci felt its touch on his arm.
"Sir, I..."
A thin, dry sound from his dying lips barely qualified as a whisper. Ricci pushed his visor up from his face, swallowed, and leaned over him. Nichols looked up at him, his lips still moving, shaping unintelligible words. Ricci took his hand into his own, bent closer. Their faces were almost touching now. Nichols grimaced, struggled out a sound.
"Wild cat. Wild. Did we..."
Ricci nodded to his closed eyes.
"We got it, Nichols. We..."
Nichols shuddered and produced a low rattle, and Ricci stopped talking, pulled in a breath that didn't seem to reach his lungs. The kid was gone, gone before the answer to his question had left Ricci's mouth. There had been 11 of them when they entered. Now there were 7, one wounded, helped along by his companions. Crouched in back of the van, Ricci peered through its level 3 ballistic cargo windows and saw 2 pairs of headlights above the black curve of road behind them. Again, no shocker. There was only the one route across the hills to the highway, and it wouldn't have taken the guards long to notice the open service gate. Ricci snapped his head toward the driver.
"Those jeeps are getting close. How far to the bridge?"
"Less than 1/2 mile. We've seen it right now if this damn road wasn't so full of twists."
Ricci breathed. The van was powered by a turbocharged V8, but its heavy armor plate hull gave the jeeps the edge in speed, and they were gaining fast. Ricci shouted to the driver,
"How are we coming?"
"Almost there. Almost. Almost."
They swung under the short concrete bridge. The driver called out, his foot tramped on the accelerator.
"We're across. We're home. I can see the chopper straight up ahead."
Ricci nodded, gave the lead jeep a chance to make the bridge. He shouted over the comlink,
"Now, Thibodeau, do it!"
At the 2 Shoulders base camp, Raleigh Thibodeau lightly fingered a switch on his handheld remote firing device, initiating the radio-addressable mines his team had affixed to the bridge support pillars. Behind the pickup van, the bridge went up with a flash and a roar, its center heaving upward and then disintegrating, an avalanche of concrete that went crashing downward, taking the jeeps and their occupants with it, mangled, burning, tumbling, down and down and down in a great dome of flame to the frozen stream bed below. Thibodeau grunted.
"Done."
Various locales. November 23, 2001.
"I thought it would be yesterday, Elliot. I was sure."
"It helps that you're here talking to him, bringing him along. His response to the inhibitor's been tremendous.
You shouldn't be discouraged if it doesn't happen right now."
Gordian opened his eyes. The room was very bright with sunlight. Ashley stood at his bedside in the brightness, looking down at him. Elliot Lieberman was next to her in his white doctor's coat.
"If what doesn't happen?"
Ashley looked at him, an almost startled expression on her face, and then leaned over the bed rail.
"This. Oh, Gord, Gord, this. Right here. Right now."
He slowly raised a hand off his sheet, touched her cheek, felt its moistness.
"Knew I had an angel on my shoulder. Didn't know angels cry."
She kissed his face, kissed it again and again, and then raised her head, smiling.
"They let us. One day each year, they let us."
He looked at her.
When?
Thanksgiving.
Tom Ricci sat alone at his kitchen table, its surface bare except for the quart bottle of Black Label he had bought at the liquor store the previous night. Last sale date before the holiday. A Thanksgiving dinner he aimed to remember. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the window shades drawn in every room of his apartment, phone off the hook, and he was about to dive into his liquid meal, swallow down as much forbidden he could hold. 100% malt. 12-step program be damned. Yes, sir, he thought. Yes, sir. Tom Gobble Gobble. Nichols, Grillo, Simmons, and Rosander on one side, Roger Gordian and the rest of the planet on the other. The whole damn planet, yes. Billions of possible victims of a germ that, in the end, because of the sacrifices of those he had led on his mission, had claimed only one good man in a small corner of Latin America. Ricci gripped the bottle. The killer. Ricci would never again call him by the name Wildcat, would never again lend him the dignity or power that name endowed. The killer, and whatever nameless, faceless taskmaster he served. Happy Thanksgiving, Ricci thought, and pulled the bottle closer, pulled it right to the edge of the table, right up against his chest. He looked at the bottle, held the bottle in both his hands, and moistened his lips with his tongue. Thirsty. So thirsty, so eager to wash the grinding pain from inside him. But the killer was still free, breathing the air, out there in the light, free. Ricci sat at the table a while longer. Then he sighed, pushed back his chair, rose to his feet, lifted his quart of expensive pure malt whiskey off the table, and strode across the kitchen to carefully set it into the wastebasket beside the sink. He had work to begin after the long weekend was over, work that might finally set the balance right. And it wasn't the sort of thing that would be easy to pull off with a hangover. Wondering what he was going to eat for dinner with all the supermarkets closed and not a scrap of food in his fridge, Ricci went to the window and opened the shade to let in what remained of the day. In one corner of Bruegel's painting on the main floor of the Prado, a cart, ridden by the servants of death, is shown rolling implacably toward a woman who has fallen across the path of its wheels, her hands clinging to a distaff and spindle. Unable to make himself leave Spain without once again viewing the masterwork, Kuhl stood before it now and thought of his lover, of the softness and delicacy of her body, and then sharply recalled their last moments together. Hours before he'd taken her to the countryside southwest of the city, they had been pressed together in their hotel room, sharing splendid intimacies behind its closed door. And then, afterward, he had suggested they take the long drive down into the Castilla y León, where the old churches and castles stood upon the hills. Kuhl had done it quickly, not wishing the pain to last. One hand over her mouth to muffle her cries, his other hand tightening on her throat. Bearing her to a thickly wooded notch in the hills, he had covered her body so the animals would find her before any man ever could. He had not wanted to let go of her, but she had known too much. The danger to him had been great. Now Kuhl took a snatch of breath, studied the Bruegel painting for a short while longer, then turned away from it and strode down the hall toward the museum exit. He had spent millions, tens upon tens of millions, and every last dollar had been wasted. Harlan Devane sat on the veranda of his expensive Spanish ranch house in the Chapari region of Bolivia, staring out at the cattle fields in silence, watching his imported heifers graze on the grass with plodding bovine contentment. He breathed, as always, without a sound, the sleeper virus that was to have gained him a fortune beyond any ever amassed, prestige beyond any imaginable height, given him the power to steer the sun across the sky, had brought him instead to abject humiliation. With the inhibitors now as commonly available as aspirin, his customers had paid vast sums for genetic triggers that were worth less to them than dust. Some had targeted victims by the hundreds, the thousands, and more. He had wanted only the death of a single man, Roger Gordian, and none had gotten the thing for which they had put their good money down. So what was left for him now? What goddamn pipes and timbrels? And because of Siegfried Kuhl's ineffectiveness, the very strong chance that the careful screens that ensured his anonymity, that allowed him to roam the world free, would begin to be peeled away. Devane closed his eyes and slowly, slowly bent his head back, so it was exposed in full to the strong tropical sun. The rays stung his pale, almost colorless skin, and he knew it would not take long before he burned. He sat there and did not move.
Tom Clancy's Power Plays, BioStrike, was created by Tom Clancy and Martin Greenberg and written by Jerome Preisler. It was read by George DeCenzo. It was abridged for audio by David Greenspan. The recording engineers were Michael Jones and Paul Fowley. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The associate producer was Will Carlino. BioStrike was produced and directed by Rick Bradley. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Tom Clancy's Power Plays, Shadow Watch. Tom Clancy's Power Plays, Politica. Tom Clancy's Power Plays, Ruthless.com. And Tom Clancy's Op Center, Divide and Conquer.